Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is the perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life there's no surrender, and there's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through. We are the ones who will never be broken.
Hello, folks, and thank you once again for coming to Bard's Logic Political Talk, part of the growing conservative conversation and also part of the Patriot Journalist Network. And you can find the Patriot Journalist Network by going to www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com. And tonight we are going to be talking about and promoting on this anniversary of Roe versus Wade, the Patriot Journalist Network's crusade to end abortion. So come tonight and talk with me, the host, our panelists, Cindy Todd, Kelly Mordecai, and James Neighbors, and our guest tonight, James Watts from the Life Training Institute, and of course with the other audience members. So please join our roundtable discussion. And Bard's Logic, as I said, we'll be discussing the Patriot Journalist Network's pro-life event, hashtag pray to end abortion. And we'll be funneling people over to the Patriot Journalist Network for all of you who are Twitter users and check out what they've got going on there. They have been promoting the hashtag pray to end abortion event all day since 1 o'clock p.m., and it goes to 11 o'clock tonight. So to check that out, go to the Patriot Journalist Network by going to www.patriotjournalist.com. And once you give them permissions through Twitter to get on to the page, then you can also share in the hashtag of pray to end abortion, and they'll show you more of how to do it there. Now, Commander Greenwald, who is also running for Congress, was serving as the ambassador for the event and started off this morning. And also, we had some support by Congressman Brennenstein, who has tweeted in our support. And we will also discuss the abortion issue as an issue of violence, as well as confront those who support abortion. The way the red meat works, and that's what we call it on the Patriot Journalist Network, is that red meat is a live Twitter fest event that has proven track record of generating thousands of tweets with a consistent message and hashtag. The technique has been instrumental in trending hashtags nationally, and during the live event, tweet buttons are presented. They have hard-hitting grassroots nominated texts on the hashtag pray to end abortion topic, which those have already been tweeted for you. And all you have to do, it's pretty simple, is to click the tweet buttons to dispatch the tweet for yourself, adding your voice to the choir of citizens on Twitter. But there's also more. Each tweet button has a retweet icon next to it that will list every tweet from those who have participated. All you do is go down the line and retweet the others who have participated. And it has a snowball effect, which everyone is supporting from one another with retweets. So come join us here and at the Patriot Journalist Network. And as I said, just by going to www.patriotjournalist.com. So for the Twitter users, definitely check that out. You are someone who rarely uses Twitter for this very important event. And we already have a number of folks on the line. But first, we'll open up with our opening guest, Mr. James Watts from the Life Training Institute. So thank you, Mr. Watts, for coming into the show. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great. You can just call me Jay, though. That'll be fine.
Okay, Jay, thank you very much. We appreciate you coming into the show tonight. So, yeah, as I said, we have a Twitter event tonight. over folks. So while you're listening, just open up a new tab and check out the Patriot Journalist Network by going to the www.patriotjournalist.com. And if you have any questions, just send me a message via Facebook or in the chat here on Blog Talk Radio. We'll start off, Jay, if you could just give us a little background about yourself and also about the Life Training Institute, we'd appreciate it. Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, our Life Training Institute, LTI, our mission is to equip pro-lifers to be able to defend their views in what we call an attractive and winsome manner, using science and philosophy and focusing on a tactical approach to the conversation, understanding that this is one of the most emotionally charged issues and objectively one of the most important moral issues that we deal with worldwide, not just in the United States. We want to equip people to have constructive conversations with the idea of winning people and arguments, not just yelling conclusions at one another. And we do that by a three-step process initially. We talk about simplifying the issue. So you focus the issue on the central question, what is the unborn? Get away from all the peripheral issues initially and just focus in on what makes abortion wrong, which is that if the unborn are human in the same way that you and I are, if we have moral obligations and duties to them the same way we do to all other human beings, then abortion is a grave moral evil. And then the second thing we do is set ourselves to demonstrating the humanity of the unborn, the full humanity of the unborn, using the science of embryology to determine that they're human beings, that they are whole, distinct, and living human beings from the moment they come into existence at fertilization, and that a philosophical question of do human beings matter is answered that during the entire course of their lifetime, that we matter, that we were not once embryos, we were embryos, and that as embryonic humans we moved through the developmental stage, but that at all stages our value came from our humanity, and it was our human nature on which our value is rooted and not what we can do functionally, not what we offer society, or not what other people think or want about or want from us. And that's in general how we operate. We go to universities, schools, churches, professional organizations. Scott Klusendorf started our ministry, and then now we have 5 permanent speakers, and then beyond that, probably about 10 at least part-time speakers that work with us. And we reached over 60,000 students last year and then millions through social media.
Awesome, and that's definitely what the hashtag Pray Down an Abortion event is going on tonight there on the Patriot Journalist Network. So folks, check that out. And that's, you know, what we're definitely promoting tonight. We also have a few other folks on, Jay, one who has some information about what she's experienced. And so I'll be letting one of our panelists on to introduce her. And then, because we do like to have a roundtable discussion, and we'll bring her in, and then we'll continue on, okay?
Okay.
Okay, and this is our panelist here, Cindy Todd. Thank you very much, Cindy, for calling to the show. How are you?
Hey there, Robert. Doing just great tonight. How are you?
Great. Oh, I'm doing good. And you're looking to introduce our one of our other guests tonight. He's going to call and tell us some of her experiences. So go ahead and do so, and then we'll bring her in so she can, you know, give us a synopsis of what she's going to discuss tonight, and then we'll bring it back to Jay, and then we will continue on with some other callers. Go ahead.
Okay, well, this is a lady that I met tonight. I went to a rally in Daytona Beach, a pro-life rally, and her name is Valeria Consuelo. And she is actually from Brazil, now living here, of course. And she is the president of the Volusia County Right to Life chapter. And she told us a story tonight, and sometime tonight I would like her to be able to relate that story. It was really cool. But just wanted to hear what, you know, kinds of things that the Volusia County Right to Life do also. Anyway. That's Ms. Valeria, and I guess she's on now.
Yes, she is. I'm opening up her mic. Thank you very much for coming to the show.
Thank you for inviting me. As she said, my name is Valeria Bonconselho. I am originally from Brazil, and I live here on this country for 22 years. And about a year in a
okay, great. Did we lose something on the mic here? Or?
I can hear her.
Well, okay, this is. I'm sorry. I thought it cut out. Go ahead.
Okay. So I live in this country for 22 years, and about a year and a half, I became the president for Volusia County Right to Life. And our organization just promote and uphold and support life, respect for human lives. And we just go like at the university, talk to students, try to educate the portion, and we stand here at the bridge in Ormond Beach. And so we do a lot of stand and to show the community that abortion is wrong. And of course, we are open 24 hours, 24/7. Our telephone is connected. So if it's the girls that have any problem during the night, weekend, they can call, and we will be able to help them. So this is the main thing that we do. And of course, we are a chapter from Florida Right to Life, and we help them with, you know, take the laws and things to the legislators so they can put this on the floor to be voted and all that thing. But the story that I was sharing tonight with our group happened a year ago. I went to Boston for my son's birthday, and I arrived in Boston on December 2nd, 2012. And it was a very cold night, and my husband went to play to the basketball game with my son, and I stayed with my daughter-in-law with three. She has three kids, my grandchildren, 5 years old, 3 years old, and year and a half. So three boys, Gabriel, Raphael, and Miguel. We call Michael, it's the same as Michael. So anyways, the story, we were outside the Queen's Market waiting for my daughter-in-law to finish her buying Christmas ornaments. And it was very cold, and I decided to start to sing, if you're happy and you know, you clap your hands, because to keep the kids warm, keep us move. And then I started to sing, and my 5 years old, he said, you know, I asked him, why are you not singing? He said, because I'm not happy. Come here, I'm going to pray for you, and then you're going to be happy. And I prayed for him, and I said, are you happy? He said, not thoroughly, just a little bit. I said, let's pray more. And then he became happy and started to clap his hand. You know the song, if you're happy, you know you clap your hand. So while we were seeing this man on his, I think, 45 years, he approached us, and he asked if he could sit in the bench that we were seating. And I said, yes, this is a public place. You're not going to kill us, are you? He said, no. So we were seating, and my grandchild, he was not clapping his hand. My grandchild came, Gabriel, the 5 years old, said, why are you not clapping your hand, sir? He said to him, because I am not happy. And he said to him, if you will not have my vovó is grandma in Portuguese, my vovó here can pray for you, and you're going to be happy. And he looked at me and said, would you? I said, yes. So, and then I told him, I'm going to have to ask my grandchildren to just be around you, put their hands in your lap, and I will be behind you, and we will going to pray for you. He said, it's okay, because I was watching the kids, and was the way that I find that kids could participate, so be more, you know. So anyways, I started to pray, and I just said a simple prayer, and I said, come Holy Spirit, and show this man what is bothering him, the conviction of his problem, why he's not happy. So I said that prayer. It was very emotional. It was not a long prayer because with the kids and everything. And I pray and say, come Holy Spirit and show him the reason why he's not happy. And we really trust in you, Lord Jesus Christ, that you are always with us. And so, and then that was it. That was it. And And then I asked him, are you feeling better? He said, yes. Actually, I am. I really feel better. And then he asked me, the kids start to play, and he asked me, may I have your phone number? I want to talk to you again. I said, yes. It's my Florida phone number. I live in Florida. I'm here just for 5 days. So, and then I gave him my phone number. He said, I'm going to call you tomorrow morning. So I said, okay. So, and the next day he called me, and he was very emotional. He said, Ms. Bonconcelho, thank you so much. I was feeling so depressed, so bad that I was thinking about kill myself when I get home. I asked him, do you need more prayer? He said, no, I'm okay. So the next day, he called me around 9 o'clock in the morning. He said, Ms. Bonconcelho, I'm calling you to let you know that I went to the church today and I had confession. And I just want to let you know that I am, or I should say, I am an ex-abortionist. I am an abortionist. I used to do abortion. I have 2 clinics. And last night when you pray for me, you and your grandchildren pray for me, I saw my whole life came like a little film. And the Holy Spirit bring the conviction that what I was doing was wrong. And I couldn't see. It looked like I was blinded all these years doing all these abortions, and I make a decision not to do anymore. And from now on, I'm going to close these 2 abortion clinics. I already called my secretary, lawyers. They're going to take care of that, close these clinics, and I'm going to open 2 clinics for this time to bring babies to life. And I will concentrate and help poor women, and I will bring more children than I kill all these years. And then I told him, you know, God, who said God has no sense of humor? I am a president of an anti-abortion organization, and so isn't that fun that the Lord brought me here to pray for somebody who is an abortionist? And that's kind of opened my eyes to see that these doctors, these people that work on abortion clinics, they need prayer. They need to be part of our prayer list daily, because I really believe what really will end abortion is prayer. And that's the story. And he kept calling me and telling me that today 10 kids came to the world by my hands, and he's keeping calling me and let me know how many kids he has bring to this world, you know. And it's such an amazing story. I asked him, would you be willing to come and give that testimony? He said, yes, but not right now, because I do not want to jeopardize the work that I am doing right now with these women, you know. So I said, yes, okay, whenever you are ready, we will be here to hear your testimony. So this is the story.
and thank you very much for sharing with us in the audience. And Cindy, real quick, I want to bring Jay back in. Tell us about more about the Life Training Institute, and perhaps some of the information he has can also, you know, help our other guests and audience members in arguing against the folks who support abortions, and tell us more about that. So go ahead, Jay.
Well, I think, first of all, that story, I think, is a great story because it illustrates a couple of things. One of the things I think it does illustrate is that this is a personal thing. Most of the people that are involved in this, I always tell audiences that I don't like to look at the other side as this group of enemies that we're working against, but that we're trying to convince people that we are right about the nature of human life so that they'll be on the right side of things. And here you have a man deeply troubled because he's involved in something obviously wrong, obviously evil for those of us who understand the nature of human life and where our values and duties and obligations come to with human beings. And so it was preying on him. And so there's multiple different ways we have to reach people. And one of the ways that we focus on, obviously, is that when we engage the other side, the first thing that we do, even though I'm a Christian, even though everybody in our organization is Christian, and even though in every presentation that we give, we do present the gospel of Jesus, and we talk about the idea that being women being restored back to a right relationship with God, and that God wants to forgive people for abortion and for what's going on and wants to restore us through this. But to engage the other side, oftentimes, especially on college campuses, you have to talk in the language that they talk in. I was just speaking at an apologetics conference this last weekend. As missionaries, when we go to other cultures, we equip ourselves in foreign countries to speak their language, to understand their culture, to reach them in a way where who we are as far as the culture we come from won't get in the way of our message. But here in the United States, we fail to recognize that we live in a post-Christian culture. And so sometimes in order to reach people with a message as simple as human life matters and that we ought not to take it without extreme justification, we have to learn to speak a language they respect. And that language is science and philosophy. So as a Christian with deeply held convictions, we're engaging the other side on what we consider to be the language that they respect and something to help them to see. Usually, actually, most people already agree with us. They don't disagree. They don't think that we ought to be able to kill human beings. They've just already decided that the unborn are not human beings before they've ever thought about it. And so one of the ways that we engage them on this is we point out to them that they would never treat a toddler the same way that we treat the unborn and use the justifications that they use. And for that, we use a tool called Trot Out the Toddler. For example, I was at an event out in California speaking on a university, and we're invited in by the campus organizations to give presentations or lectures. And I've given a lecture, and at the end I open up the floor to questions. And a gentleman stands up, and he says, you know, Roe v. Wade, since today is Roe v. Wade Day, Roe v. Wade says that a woman has a right to privacy. And I don't know that most people are aware of that, but Roe v. Wade does root the right to perform abortions in the woman's right to make free medical decisions without interference from the government. It's a privacy issue. And he says, women have a right to privacy. And so I ask him this question. I say, sir, I have a 2-year-old standing next to me, and I put my hand on my hip. I said, this 2-year-old little girl is my next-door neighbor. In the privacy of her own home, her father viciously abuses her every day. This little girl's life is one humiliation after another in the privacy of their own home. The only time she has any release or relent from this living just torment that she lives in, this oppression, is when she's out in public. He said, would it be okay with you if we as a community invaded the privacy of their home and took this girl out of it in order to protect her from that abuse? And the gentleman in the back said, well, of course it would be okay to take her out of that home. So we asked the question, why? Why would it be okay to take her out? It's happening in the privacy of their own home. This is a private matter between the family, the father and the daughter. Why does the government or do we as a community have a right to interject in there? So, well, because she's a human being, and we can't do that to human beings. You're not allowed to abuse human beings. See? Okay, then. If the unborn human in the same way that toddler is, then we're not going to allow people to abuse them for the reason of privacy as well. You see, it's not an issue of privacy, like Roe v. Wade says. It's a question of what are the unborn. And so we have to focus the conversation there. Greg Kokel does a great demonstration, the President of Stand to Reason, where he says, imagine you're at your sink and you're washing dishes and your grandchild walks in, or whoever for the purposes of the environment walks in behind you. For me, I usually use my 9-year-old daughter, Mary Jackson, because she walks in behind me and she asks this question, Daddy, can I kill this? Can I kill this? Well, I can't answer that until I determine what it is that she has. What it is that she has will determine my answer. If it's a bug, I'm the only person in the house that kills bugs right now. I'd be thrilled if she would join the ranks of the bug killers in the Watts household. If it's the neighbor's cat, that would be a terrible thing, just because as much as that cat can frustrate me sometimes by jumping out and scaring me when it hides in my bushes, it would affect my relationship with my neighbor. And I don't want to tell my cat, my child she's allowed to kill cats. If it's her little sister, then the answer is absolutely not. Let her go. What it is changes our answer to that question. And so we have to lock in like a laser when we're talking to people to help them see that about 98% of the time, the overwhelming majority of the time, the person in front of us doesn't think it's okay to kill a class of human beings. They just don't think the unborn are human in the same way that you and I are. And so that's where we start. Do they understand what the unborn are? And we make our case there and try to point out those errors for them. Another major error people make discussing this, and this is endemic to our entire society right now, just to point out, I was talking to a guy who's a philosophy and ethics professor at the Naval Academy, the U.S. Naval Academy, and this guy, obviously not a bastion of liberalism there. He says all of my kids that come in, all of the young men and women that come in the Naval Academy, they're all relativists. Their default position is that they think personal preferences that all things are a matter of personal preference, and they don't think there's any such thing as objective moral values, or at least that kind of thinking doesn't come easy for them. And so we have to train them out of this way of thinking and demonstrate for them that such a thing as objective moral values exists. Subjective values are those things like, or subjective truth would be like, I love bacon, which is true. I love bacon. I had bacon tonight.
I think bacon
is God's most perfect. Yeah, bacon is just flat out awesome. Everything is better with bacon. If you go to my Facebook page right now, I've got, you know, people scoring up, lining up to talk about bacon with me because I talk about it so much. One of my kids for years hated bacon. Just, I couldn't understand why. I was like, look at it. I was like, you look like a normal human being. I don't understand what happened to you. We raised you right. How can you not like bacon? And her response was, Daddy, it's this easy. I put bacon in my mouth, and I don't like it. You put it in your mouth, and you love it. And that's the textbook definition of a subjective truth or subjective claim. I give you information about me, the subject. But let's say somebody said something to me like this. They say, you don't like abortions and don't have one. Well, when they hear me saying I don't like abortion or that I think abortion's wrong, what they think I'm saying is I don't like abortion. They don't realize that what I'm talking about is an objective claim, not a bacon claim or an ice cream claim or a candy claim, but a claim about what's objectively wrong for all people at all times. It's wrong to murder somebody. It's wrong to rape somebody. It's wrong to torture toddlers for fun. Abortion is in that classification is wrong. Not wrong like I don't like bacon, but wrong like it's wrong to rape a woman. And so we have to train them to see the difference there. And oftentimes, people that you would think were our allies are making this mistake. One of the conversations that everybody in our ministry, I think, has had at some point or another is where I was at a church campus personally. For me, it happened the first time, and this gentleman came up to me and said, what are you doing here? So I'm here to talk to your pastor. He asked who I was. I told him who I was in the organization that I work for. And he said, so you talk about abortion? I said, yes, I do. He said, do you want to know what I think? I said, yeah, sure, go ahead. He said, I think abortion is wrong, but I don't think I ought to be able to tell other people what they're allowed to do. And so here's one of the things we train people. Instead of getting into arguments or fights or looking for opportunities to tell everybody else what you think, look for opportunities to ask clarifying questions. Best way to get into a constructive conversation, make it question-centered. And so I ask them this question. Do you mind telling me why you personally think abortion is wrong? And he said, well, I personally think abortion is wrong because I think it's killing a human being. I think it's killing babies. I said, okay, sir, do you mind if I repeat back to you what I just said, what you just said to me? And he said, no, sure, go ahead. I said, you just told me that you personally think abortion is wrong because it kills babies, but you think it ought to be legal to kill babies. And he just stopped for it, thought about it for a moment, and he said, that doesn't sound right, does it? Like, no, it doesn't. It doesn't sound right. But the problem you're having is a problem that just is a part of our whole culture. We don't see right and wrong anymore. We see personal preferences. And so those two things are vitally important as we're trying to center the question on what is the unborn, as recognizes that our audience has usually either made up their mind that the unborn are not human, or even if they personally think abortion is wrong, they're confused on the difference between subjective or personal preference claims and objective claims, and they classify abortion as something like a bacon question or an ice cream question as opposed to a rape question or a murder question.
Well, thank you very much, for that information. And definitely check out the book by Kusendorf. It's called A Case for Life. I've read it some years ago and definitely would like to read some more. Or read it again, I should say. It does definitely have some great arguments in them and a lot of logical arguments. Well, we've got a lot of folks on the line tonight, and we will be getting to everyone who'd like to chime in. And for those who are listening and would like to chime in as well, just push the 1 on your number dial, and I'll let you in. It's some part of the show, I promise. We've got plenty of time. But, of course, while you are waiting to come in and listening, just hit another tab and open it up and go to www.patriotjournalist.com and check them out. Also, it's under the Red Meat Steakhouse. They're having a Twitter event tonight, which is the hashtag #PrayToEndAbortion. So definitely check that out. It's what we're promoting tonight. There is a link to it right there in the description of the show here on Blog Talk Radio. So copy the link and paste it into the browser so you can check it out there on the other tabs. You can listen to the show at the same time as participating in the Pray to End Abortion event on the PatriotJournalist.com. And so we do have another story from one of our panelists in here tonight, And we have Kelly Mordecai, and we also have James Neighbors, who will be coming in later. I do see on the line James, so we'll be letting you in, as well as other audience members who will be chiming in tonight. But first, we will have the author of The Hidden Fourth Branch, and also a website of the same name at www.hiddenfourthbranch.com. And that's another one of our panelists here on Bard's Logic, and that is Kelly Mordecai. Thank you very much, Kelly, for coming into the show. How are you?
Hey, Robert. I'm just really glad to I'm just your guest. Like, you know, I'm about to start to cry, okay? This is a very issue that's very close to my heart. In fact, my entire being. Five doctors told my mother to abort me. So this is very, obviously, somewhat tough for me. But I wanted to tell just a few stories. The first person that I pulled across the line to being pro-life happened when I was in college working in the fields detasseling corn. And he's like, well, a woman has a right to choose. I was like, well, yeah, she does. And the government has a right to impose a consequence, which is if I go murder somebody, the state has the authority to kill me, give me capital punishment for choosing to, you know, for my choice of murdering someone. So, yeah, a woman has a right to choose, but she doesn't have the right to choose her consequences. And it's sad that, well, it was a good thing that my friend, college friend, that he actually changed his point of view. But we have, this is an eternal law. Our Creator has woven freedom into every fiber of creation. We do have the right to choose our choices. We do not have the right to choose our consequences. And so many women have suffered years later and continue to suffer after they had an abortion. Of course, Planned Parenthood won't tell you that. But that conversion story is one, you know, I kind of, you know, like when somebody comes at you with a knife, you move out of the way and then you grab them and you throw them on the ground. That was kind of how I used an argument of his own to get him to convert a few days later that, hey, yeah, okay, I'm pro-life now. But I told him my story of five doctors telling my mother to abort me. In August 65, my mother, my father and mother became pregnant with me, and she had a low-grade fever. They did not know what it was. They just they couldn't find it, and they told my mother, hey, look, you know, you got three other kids to take care of, and you got this big farm operation, and I'm sorry, but your baby is going to be born blind or deaf or missing an arm or retarded or even dead, and we really recommend you have an abortion. I couldn't hear those comments. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. What was that? Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know if someone had comments or if that was somebody talking in the background. If you are going to say something in the background, just mute your mic until or your phone, whichever you're calling in on, until you jump back in. Hello?
Thank you. Press um botão para.
I'm sorry.
Should I continue, Robert?
Now, yeah, go ahead, Kelly.
Okay. Well, so anyway, August 65, mother had an infection. They didn't know what it was. Months of testing, she was concerned. My dad was concerned. The doctor told her, you need to abort this baby or, you know, you could even end up dead yourself, blah, blah, blah. My mother and father went home, and they prayed, and they're like, we are going to love this baby no matter what happens. Retarded, blind, and we are going to love him. I do not want this on my conscience. They both agreed. They did not want an abortion on their conscience, and of course, I was born, and she weighed 95 pounds. Normally, she weighs 120 pounds, and 120 pounds, but she weighed 95 pounds after she had me. And the doctors were just absolutely amazed. They had emergency vehicles. This is in Iowa. One to go to Rochester if this problem, or one to go to another hospital if I had these problems, and the doctors just couldn't believe that I was normal. And, of course, here I am, and I'm chattering away. But the third story I want to tell you about is how I helped someone and they did not have an abortion. This is kind of a hard one too, because I learned the sensitivities of this situation. I'll just call her Susan and her boyfriend Bob. Well, they got pregnant. I knew Bob's uncle, and he told me that they were going to have an abortion. They had to drive 2 hours to do it and had to get approval locally. And I called her up and I said, hey, look, you know, I've heard that I Bob and Susie. I heard that you were thinking about having an abortion. She says, yeah, I tell you what, I'll give you $10,000 for your baby. That was the most insensitive thing I could do, and it really upset her, which I found out later. But I said, you know, you might want to choose life or something. And then I called up Bob's uncle, and we had an intervention at 7 o'clock in the morning. We showed up at their apartment before they had to make the trip 2 hours for the dirty deed. And I told them my story. And I said, you know, you guys need help or whatever. And so Bob's nephew, they went to the clinic, but at the door, all of a sudden, something kicked in. Something kicked in, his conscience, his previous Catholic upbringing, whatever it was, and they just freaked out. And he said, I can't do this. I just can't. And finally, she felt free enough because she wanted to keep it, but he was pressuring her. And what is the study? 90% of relationships break up when a guy pressures to have an abortion. But they came back. She had the baby. And she named this little girl. I'm sorry. she named this little girl Faith. And I've seen this girl and her mother around town every now and then. And if we use gentleness, if we use stories, if you just give people support and love, they make the right choice. And little Faith is alive today because somehow I blundered through some mistakes but found the grace at 7 in the morning to help some people.
That's a beautiful story, Kelly. Thank you very much for sharing with everything, with everybody. You know, I'm definitely touched by it, and I appreciate you sharing that with us. Go on. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I had never heard you tell that, Kelly. I'm glad to have heard it.
It just love wins. Love and support.
And I think that story underlies also just the incredible kind of work that you see done all over this country at pregnancy resource centers. Pregnancy centers at the community level I've worked at one for 3 years, and then I'm on the board of directors of that same one now as I've moved on to Life Training Institute. But what you just kept saying was that when someone is in crisis, there's fear. I think it's telling that she named her child Faith. I mean, there's a fear there of the future. And Lori Parker, the head of Cobb Pregnancy Services, just one of the most godly and beautiful women I've ever known in my life. I used to listen to her when she would talk to people, and they would come in afraid. They were terrified. It was all this pressure of what they thought was coming. And she would say to them at that moment, this baby's not coming right now. You know, you have time, and you have a community that's willing to help you out, to work with you. And just at that point, to stop them at that moment of crisis and fear. And instead of feeding that fear, which is something I think you were seeing at that when you were talking about those doctors, those five doctors that were advising your mother to abort you, feeding that fear, feeding that doubt about the future, as opposed to somebody being able to find hope at that moment, hope and love and security in the sense that there are people around that are looking out for you and want the best for you. And in the fight against this, that is just one of the pregnancy centers and counselors that are praying at those centers. I mean, you have people that are just investing their personal love and spirituality and prayer into this. And that is such a huge part of this fight. And it is one of the most troubling aspects to me that the other side seeks to characterize that as bad all the time. That's one of the things I find most unsettling, is that they look at one of the most compassion and love-filled groups of people that I've ever worked around or been around in my entire life, and they categorize them as dishonest and bad and focus the media on them as if they were doing a disservice to their community, which there's nothing could be further from the truth.
All right, well, at this time, folks, we do have another one of the Bard's Logic panelists in, and this is James Neighbor, who's also the founder of Overpasses for America. And check out his site at www.overpassesforamerica.org. Or there's Connie, he'll let us know if I made a mistake there or not. And so also for America, also on Facebook. Thank you very much, James, for coming to the show. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great, Robert. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. We have a very important discussion tonight, of course, about on this anniversary of Roe versus Wade. And before we continue further, for those of you out there who are Twitter users, definitely check out the patriotjournals.com, their hashtag Pray to End Abortion event that they're having over there. And just go to the description there on Blog Talk Radio and just copy it, open up a new tab, and paste it and check it out. And it's real easy to do, and they'll explain how you can participate once you're there. So you can either cut and paste or copy and paste the link I provided there in the description, or you can go to www.patriotjournalist.com and check out what they call the Red Meat Steakhouse there. And if you have any questions on it, just ask me in chat or send me a message via Facebook. So go ahead, James. So for folks who will go over there and check that out. James, you have the mic.
Ooh, pardon me. What good timing. Just as soon as I started to speak, I had to cough. I used to be one of those fence riders on the entire abortion topic for a very long time. It wasn't until I found my way back to God and it wasn't anything anybody said to me. It was just suddenly I just had a realization and an inspiration that, was just wrong. And I had to debate over that myself internally for a very long time, but, quite a while. Why is it wrong? I mean, we've been taught our whole lives, that it's a woman's right to choose. And, it is their body. It is their body. And, and it finally just dawned on me that, it is their body, but that's also their body to be responsible with. And that's not the body, it's not their body that's inside of them that they can decide whether lives or dies. They can, certainly, but, as was said earlier, the consequence of that decision is not their choice. And, it's kind of like an analogy I like to use, and it makes a lot of people angry. And so if I upset anybody or if I make anybody angry, I'm not intending to, because it's kind of an in-your-face analogy, and I kind of have a tendency to do that. If you're driving down the highway to work and you're running late, and somebody is in front of you, and they're driving too slowly for what you need or for what you feel like you need to travel to get to work, and you just lose control of your temper, you come to a stoplight, and you take out your .44 Magnum, and you walk up to that car, and you shoot them in the face. Well, you just ended a life, and you're going to be held responsible for that. But the justification for abortion on demand is exactly the same as that person that just committed road rage murder. And something that was an inconvenience to that person in that vehicle caused them to act in an irrational fashion and end another life. And why do people say, the majority of people say that why they got the abortion? It's because when it boils right down to it, is that child would have been an inconvenience for their preferred life. Well, and I know that's it's harsh, but unfortunately,
you're absolutely right though.
Thank you, and that's what the justification is. So if a person, a woman, well, it has to be a woman, obviously. We don't have technology like that yet. you know, decides to go get an abortion because a baby is going to change their life and become an inconvenience for them, then why can't road rage murders be legal? I mean, they're both ending a life for the sake of an inconvenience. And if you were to ask a person, well, if you get in my way and cause me to be late to work, should I be able to shoot you and kill you so I can get to work faster? Their answer will, of course, be, well, no. I'm like, well, then why should somebody be able to end the life of the baby that was going to be an inconvenience to them and, you know, change their life, and they very rarely get the correlation, and I think it's just because they don't want to. Occasionally, it does reach somebody. But my whole thing is you look at modern society as it is today in 2014, and you look at the complete, utter lack of personal responsibility. You know, you could start at the top and you look at Congress. If they were being responsible legislators, we wouldn't have the problems that we're having in Washington, D.C. right now. If you were to look at corporations and they were being responsible with how they were operating their companies, there wouldn't be corporate bribery and, you know, pollution and workers that aren't getting paid perhaps as much as what they should be for what they're doing for you. You look at the 30-year-old slacker living in his parents' basement. Again, it boils down to responsibility. He's not exercising his responsibility as he should as an adult to be a productive citizen. When you took away the responsibility or the necessity of responsibility from somebody, from somebody that's the giver of life, the bringer of life into this world, when they're no longer being held accountable for the responsibility with that wonderful privilege, it infects the entirety of society. Because if you are no longer have to be responsible for that monumental thing that's indeed responsible for the existence of the human race. I mean, we're talking the ultimate responsibility that's now you're no longer responsible for that. Well, if a person doesn't have to be responsible for that and they can instead go commit infanticide for the sake of wanting to shirk their responsibilities, then who cares what anybody else does? I mean, who cares if you're the president and you're driving the country into the ground? Who cares if you're manufacturing methamphetamine and turning people into addicts? Who cares if you're a crooked cop and throw people in jail for things they didn't do? What difference does anything else a person can do in comparison to the killing of a baby? There really isn't anything you can compare that to. And I believe the mindset of those of the ability to kill a child for the convenience of it has infected our society. And as long as it continues to stand, and people are allowed to, you know, the acceptance of irresponsibility is allowed in this country, we're not going to improve things here.
Well, and I'd like to interject, James, and I'll bring our guest, Mr. Watts, on, and then we'll have Chuck waiting on the line. I do see some other folks who'd like to chime in, and as I promised, we'll be bringing everyone who'd like to chime in tonight to be a part of our roundtable discussion. But I've got a couple quotes here. You know, I wrote a paper some years ago about abortion as an issue of violence, and I've got some quotes here by Mother Teresa that I incorporated to the paper. And, you know, she said, "Any country that accepts abortion is not teaching its people to love, but to use any violence to get what it wants." And another one is, "The greatest destroyer of peace today is abortion, because it is a war against a child. And if we accept that a mother can kill even her own child, how can we tell other people not to kill one another?" And so I think, you know, that's pretty indicative of what you were saying, James. But at this time, I do want to bring it to back to our guest, Jay Watts from the Life Training Institute. So go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, there's a couple of things I'd like to touch on. But first, both James and Kelly talked about the argument, or not an argument, when people say women have a right to choose. There's several bad ways that people argue about abortion, and one of those is what we call they assert rather than argue. So when somebody says women have a right to choose, they're not arguing for their reasons. They're just what we call asserting. They're making a claim without argument altogether. And first of all, this is a naked claim. Greg Kokel has a great response to that. He said, we've used this oftentimes when I do Q&As, even at universities, when somebody stands up to me and says, women have a right to choose. So what if I said this back to you? Women have a right to take. Women have a right to take. And they just look at me and say, what would we need to finish that? What's the question that hasn't been answered? What is looming out there for everybody? They said, take what? That's right. I said, to say nakedly women have a right to take without explaining what it is by virtue of the nature of what it is they're taking and the action that they're doing, I'm not saying anything. I'm simply what we call asserting it. I'm just claiming it without argument. And we don't have to, if somebody says to you, women have a right to choose, what happens oftentimes is that we respond by trying to come up with a great argument to support our position. And that's not necessary. The burden is on the person making the claim. And so when someone says the woman has a right to choose, well, I said, well, choose what? Exactly what is it that women have a right to choose? Well, they say if a woman has a right to choose abortion, why? What gives women the right to make this choice? When you're saying women have the right to have abortion, what you're saying is that women have the right to kill their unborn children. What gives them that right? And make them articulate their case. Don't let them off the hook. Don't let people just say things and feel like we now have pressure to prove the pro-life position. The first thing that has to happen when somebody makes a claim is that they have a responsibility for standing up for it, owning it, and presenting an argument for their claim. But all too often, because we passionately believe what we believe, and I'm one of them. I have tremendous passion, obviously, for this issue. We feel driven to immediately make our case. Put pressure on the other person to make their case. Make them explain what it is that they believe, because oftentimes they can't. Oftentimes they have the slightest idea why they believe what they do. So when someone has women have a right to choose, we need to make them tell us choose what and why they have this right. Another question that came up when you're talking about it is their body, James correctly then said it's not their body. Remember, I said that from the moment of fertilization, we have a whole distinct and living human being. When I say distinct, they're not a part of the father or the mother. They may be geographically inside the mother. It's their environment. That's where they're located. But they are not a part of her. And they are not a part of the unborn child inside of the mother is not an organ of the mother's. It is a whole distinct and living human being all of its own. It's whole. It's not a part. It's distinct. It's different from every cell in the body of the mother and the father, and it's alive. It has its own cellular reproduction. It responds to stimuli. It's metabolizing energy, and it is internally coordinating its growth towards its own physical maturation separate from its mother. And it certainly does use an organ of its own, which we argue oftentimes whether it's an organ or not, the placenta, to gather nourishment from the mother because that's the way it communicates or takes nourishment or metabolizes things from the outside. But none of that belongs to the mother bodily. All of that is the body of the unborn child. And when we ask people, why is it okay? One of the things that we do is we call it a diagnostic question. When I ask somebody, after I've talked about subjective and objective claims, and after I've talked about the nature of the unborn and things like that, I'll ask them this question. I'll say, you know, would it be objectively wrong for me to kill you right now? Almost everybody says yes. Almost everybody says it would be objectively wrong for me to kill them right now if we're just standing there. And I say, would it be wrong for me to kill you? They said, yes. I said, okay, what is the difference between you now and the embryo that you once were, that it was a legally protected right for me to kill you then, but if I were to kill you now, what would we call it? And so we would call it murder. Okay, what is the difference? What has changed? What made you at one point the kind of thing that we could kill for no reason at all? Because James is correct in saying the overwhelming majority of abortions are done for reasons of convenience. The overwhelming majority of abortions have nothing to do with life of the mother or rape or incest or any of the what we call the hard cases. Not that those justify abortion. That's a different conversation. But the overwhelming majority of them are things like finances, fears for future. It's just not the right time is one of the most often given answers. I'm just not ready. All of these things that happen. What gives you the right for us to kill you for those reasons then, but we can't do it now? Those would be not sufficient reason to kill you now. We would call that murdering you. And they give you what we call the SLED acronym, size, level of development, environment, or degree of dependency. That's the SLED acronym. One of those four things, size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency. And we argue that none of those things do enough philosophical work to justify what we're doing to the unborn, which we would see as an abhorrent moral action to somebody born or afterwards. And so size, we don't get value from our size, level of development, people who assign value based on developmental criteria. One of the things I do think James is pointing out there as we start to talk about what wouldn't we do? Well, that does infect our society now. Now that we're saying that we can kill this class of human being, recognizing that they are human, because almost everybody does. Nobody argues that they're not human. They just argue that they're human, it's human life that doesn't matter. And so they say, we're allowed to do that because these particular human beings can't do this particular thing, whether it's consciousness, whether it's feel pain, however they're arguing or parsing, have desires. There's different arguments that they offer. What we also do is we apply that at the end of life. As we see these waning rational thought, capacities, consciousness, if we see these things, we see troubling things where we say, that's not the kind of life that's worth living, or we see people who have been severely injured, and we say, well, that kind of person is living a life that isn't worth living, or somebody with terrible disease, that's not a life worth living. Why? Because we have assigned value by some level of development criteria or something that they must be able to do functionally in order to count as a valuable human being, as opposed to what we argue for. All human beings have value by virtue of what they are. So size, level, development, environment is just where you are, and degree of dependence is how much you need other people. Certainly the unborn are dependent in ways that the rest of us are not. My daughter, just this last year, my 9-year-old daughter, MJ, who I mentioned earlier, at 8, she was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. One Sunday, she was this radically independent little girl. The next Monday morning, we were in the emergency room. Her whole life changed. She became dependent on insulin for the rest of her life. She's radically dependent on the family. Mostly my wife, taking over almost the job heroically of being my daughter's pancreas and working with her to make sure that she has what she needs as far as balance of glucose and insulin to be healthy. She is radically dependent. But the growth of that dependence on that one day did not make her less valuable as human beings. She didn't suddenly become something that was a lesser offense to kill because her dependency grew. Just like her elderly do not become something that's a lesser offense to kill simply because they grow dependent on us, because we are all dependent. But we are all of these things, size, levels of total environment, degree of dependency, by virtue of degrees. They're all what we call degreed properties. We have bigger, more or less size. We have more or less capacities within our developmental arc. We are here and there changing constantly, and our dependence radically changes at different times throughout the course of our life. Those things come and go by degrees. That everybody understands value is not something that we have by degrees generally. We should understand that it's something that we just have all of or not at all. And so anything that has a degreed nature to it, like size, level of development, environment, degree of dependency, it's not a great place to look to ground our value as human beings in.
Yeah, those are some great arguments, and a lot of those sound familiar from what's in the book by Mr. Klisdorf, The Case for Life. And I highly recommend for anyone who'd like to have these conversations, you know, with folks, especially for those who are abortion supporters, to get that book, read
Barbara,
it, and really get to know.
Quickly?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I wanted to say one other thing in response to what James was saying, because essentially, remember, James gave the demonstration of the road rage incident. I wanted to point out that essentially the road rage incident is basically what I offered earlier and trot out the toddler. But there's one key difference in it, because James says people find that offensive. And the reason that they'll find it offensive is because it is focusing on the moral nature of the action, which is what I'm doing and what all of us who use Trot Out the Toddler are doing. When we say, would you kill a toddler for the reason that you've offered for getting an abortion? Would you kill this 2-year-old standing next to me for that reason? And if you wouldn't, it's because you assume that the unborn are not human in the same way that the 2-year-old, this hypothetical 2-year-old that we're talking about, is. But one of the reasons that they're going to find that offensive, and one of the things we have to be careful of when we're trying to convince people in a conversation on the street, and we only have a couple minutes to do it, is that we are sensitive to the pressures that are driving women, the crisis that they find themselves in, the emotional pressures, the pressures from family or boyfriends. We don't discount those as unimportant. What we're trying to convince them of is that the life, the value of the human life that they're going to take overrides that those emotional concerns at the moment. And that, and so what child the toddler does is exactly what the road rage thing does, but in a conversational, at a point where you're trying to convince somebody who disagrees with you, what it does is it gives you the opportunity to acknowledge that those things are still things that we need to recognize. For example, when somebody stood in front of me and said, was talking about finances and the financial pressure that's on their family, and that with people who have this tremendous financial pressure, they ought to be able to choose whether or not to have a child at this point. Well, we know when they say that, they already do have a child. The child's already there. But we have to help them to understand the decision that they're making and that they have dismissed that child as existing. And so when I ask them, okay, I say, let me just walk this. So they have a two-year-old child sitting next to me. The two-year-old child, she's the fourth of four children. There's no doubt that since she's been born, her family's resources have been stretched tremendously. There's no doubt that since she was born, her mother has had to take a separate job. The three older kids are getting less attention from their parents. Everybody in the family has less because this child is here, and the family resources have been stretched beyond anything that they had prior to the birth of this two-year-old child. Would it be okay with you if we killed this two-year-old child in order to relieve the financial burden, the real and genuine financial burden that this family finds themselves in? Now, you notice that as I go through that, I genuinely identify with the people that are under financial strain. I don't want to minimize it. I don't want to act like it's nothing because I would be insensitive to the pressures that they're feeling or at least the justifications that they're offering, which I'm not insensitive to. I'm just saying that however tremendous that financial burden is, would it be okay with you to kill this two-year-old to relieve it? I have never had anybody say yes. Everybody says no, of course not. Why? Well, because we don't kill human beings because they're expensive or they cause a financial strain. That's just not what we do. Okay, then. If the unborn are human the same way this toddler is, then we cannot use financial burdens as an excuse for killing them as well. The question isn't finances. The question is what are the unborn? So let's focus on that. And we're making the same case that James was making with the road rage thing, but hopefully when we get skilled with that kind of a case, we're making it in a way that says two things. I get what you're saying. I understand your objection. I understand why this emotional element is so important to you, but it's not important enough to take human life, and you believe that. You already believe that. You just don't believe the unborn are human in the same way these toddlers are.
Again, more great arguments. And at this time, I do want to bring in another caller. And we have here on the line Chuck, and Chuck is from the ConstitutionWar.org. And so I want to welcome you, Chuck, for coming into the show, opening up your mic. Thank you for coming in. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Doing really well. Thank you very much for coming to the show. And also,
yeah.
Folks, before you continue on, Chuck, I do want to have folks who are listening in that's new, definitely go, if you're here on Blog Talk Radio, listening through there, check out the link we have here to the PatriotJournalist.com. There's a link to the Pray to End Abortion campaign got it over there, or go to the www.PatriotJournalist.com and check out the Red Meat hashtag and just follow it from there. Go ahead, Chuck.
Yeah, I just want to make sure you're hearing me all right.
I'm hearing you great.
Yep,
yeah,
I hear you just fine.
Very, very good. Just want to make sure my connection was good. Well, I'll tell you what, guys. I mean, incredible show. I've cried, stopped crying, cried again, and now I'm just euphoric with the spirit of Jesus Christ, our Savior. And I know all of you, I believe all of you agree with me on that. And what is happening with the pro-life movement is nothing short of amazing. But what I would bring it back to, and obviously, you know, I play a political angle on a lot of stuff, but I would bring it back to is how did we get to this level? And we got to this level of 56 million dead babies, more than all the wars in U.S. history, more than all the wars in a lot of histories. We got there because of politics. We got there because the nine men in black robes decided that every single state shall allow abortion in their state. And we have it here in North Carolina. The people here in North Carolina don't want it, but it exists. and it's a scourge on this nation, and it's a scourge like slavery was on this nation. And if we look back during the times of slavery, we will see that 11 northern states used a protocol, or I'm not sure what you would call it, nullification. And nullification was successful in nullifying the Fugitive Slave Act, because the Supreme Court said that Joshua Glover was not a man, but he was he was a slave. He was property of somebody else. We have the same issue going on with these unborn fetuses, which are inside the wombs of mothers, and God bless them, and God pray for them. And this is, I am not somebody who wants to beat the abortionist the mother or the abortionist over the head. I want it to stop, and I want it to stop really badly, and I'll get to that in a second and how we want to do that, because we are going to. Joshua Glover was a fugitive slave from the state of Missouri, and the state of Wisconsin had, their Supreme Court in Wisconsin had nullified the Fugitive Slave Act and said, we will not return Joshua Glover to the state of Missouri and to slavery because he is a man and we will allow him to stay in our state. They nullified that. We can, each one of these states, one by one, nullify Roe versus Wade. We can nullify it and we can end abortion in probably about 38 states in this country. Now, look into nullification, go to tomwoods.com, whatever you got to do if you want to see that. I've been talking about pushing an initiative through constitutionalwar.org to start a nullification process, and I tried to do it this past year at our GOP convention to nullify Roe versus Wade here in the state of North Carolina, and I can share with you that resolution that I was trying to pass through our party's platform. But aside from that, aside from looking into nullification, I want to talk about the real nature of politics and how the pro-life movement really describes it better than any other movement, because the pro-life movement came along to a Republican Party that, believe it or not, folks, was not always as pro-life as it says it is today. The Republican Party was forced, brute force, and that's what politics is. And that's what I deal in, is politics. And politics is brute force. You either answer the question the right way or you answer it the wrong way. And I want to get you on video doing one of the two. Now, the pro-life movement took on the issue of abortion and said, if you are not pro-life, you don't get elected as a Republican. And that's the reason why we've had so much success. You cannot get elected in almost anywhere in the country as a Republican if you're not pro-life, and that's the way it should be. And for those who disagree with me on that, I would hope that if you disagree with me on the issue of I do want to use government force to stop abortion completely in this country, if you disagree with me on using government force to stop abortion, I hope and I pray you have a different opinion when it comes to rape. Because if you're truly against abortion, then you do want to use government force to stop it. And when I go to these rallies, when Planned Parenthood, and I go there and I protest with my good friend Brooke McGowan, I'm not sure if she's listening, or Donna Mone's daughters have done some really great stuff here in my state of North Carolina, and Flip Benham and many others. When I go to these rallies and they tell me, and they have a coat hanger on a sign, and they say, never again, I say, yes, again. Because if you're going to have an abortion, you're going to have to shoot yourself in the stomach, stick a knife up in you, or use a coat hanger. Because there is no reason our government should allow you to do it any other way. And actually, we're not going to allow that either. We're going to put your ass in jail if you do that. And if you don't agree with me on that, I would respectfully say that you're not pro-life, because pro-life to fight for against slavery, to fight against the Holocaust that happened in Germany, and the fight against the Holocaust that's happening here in America right now, the only way you can fight against that is by all means necessary and brute force. And I want to stop abortion by brute force. This doesn't mean I'm going to go kill an abortionist, blow up myself, a suicide, something, or just send a truck bomb in there. That's ridiculous. That does nothing. Okay, that would change absolutely nothing. And I do agree. One thing I do agree with is the education theory of how to change the way politics works, it's an absolute farce, except for one thing, and that is abortion, because abortion, you can educate people and change the way they think. But if you truly want to stop abortion, and you want to stop it everywhere, the way that you do that is through political maneuvering, and you do it the same way that they freed Joshua Glover as a slave from the state of Missouri. He was a man. They called him a slave. And when he escaped to the state of Wisconsin, the Supreme Court of the state of Wisconsin had said, no, we are overturning what the federal government has said. And the states do have the rights to do that. So that's the first step. The second step is you do not ever vote for anybody who is pro-choice. I don't give a damn how bad the economy is and how bad Barack Obama is. Mitt Romney stood there in front of a camera and said, not only am I pro-choice, but I defend Massachusetts rights, when Massachusetts laws, when it says if a woman is under the age of 18, she can go to a judge or a school teacher. And when a little girl under the age of 18 in the state of Massachusetts can go to a judge or a school teacher and get an affidavit and go to an abortion mill and kill her child, until we stop voting for those people, we will never, ever win. And I know a lot of people disagree with me on that, and that's fine. But the same thing goes for Rick Santorum. When Rick Santorum tells you he's pro-life, and then he goes out there and campaigns for Christine Todd Whitman to be the governor of New Jersey, who is 100% pro-choice, that is pro-murder. Folks, you can't compromise. If you compromise, you lose. You lose. And the pro-life movement got its foothold because they didn't compromise. You know what they said? They said they didn't give a damn how many elections they lost. If you are a Republican, we're in the Republican Party. If you're a Republican and you're not pro-life and 100% pro-life, you don't get our vote. And that's how this party turned into a pro-life party. And we're starting, I wouldn't say we're starting to lose that, but there are elements of that out there. I mean, you look at the support of Rudy Giuliani, who was 100% pro-choice. His campaign crashed and burned, but everybody loved him there for a minute or two. The only way that you can change this, You can go and you can tell the most heart-wrenching stories, and I love them. And you can go and do what I do and go to the abortion mills, and you can go to the communist, socialist, HK on J, and I shared that video with Cindy, and I use reggae music and I think some rap music that is anti-abortion in that video. It's a video I put out called Making Pro-Life Cool. And if you watch that video, every single black person that I talked to in that video was pro-life. And about half of the white people were too. And the white liberals that are pro-choice are of the mindset of Margaret Sanger, okay, and they want abortion because they don't want those unwanted minority babies. Are you going to adopt them? Yeah, I would. Absolutely. We prayed with a friend of ours who she was a white woman, but she was about to have she already had abortion, and she was impregnated by a black friend of hers, and she didn't want to have the baby. And we begged her and begged her and begged her. And I know the gentleman earlier said he had offered somebody $10,000, and that's kind of that Mitt Romney bet from the debates. But, I mean, maybe he actually had it. I don't know. I didn't have anything like that. And we have five children. We've had five children in 7 years. And I would more than happily take that baby to save that life. It would be a struggle. I'm not sure that it is feasible for someone like me to be able to take on everybody's baby that wants abortion, everybody's baby where the mother wants an abortion. That's not the case, though, folks. That's not the case at all. What is the case? You have thousands and thousands of Christians out there waiting to adopt these babies, and the government gets in the way of that. And the government stops those adoptions from happening. And in the state here of North Carolina, we have a Republican governor, a Republican Supreme Court, a Republican House, and a Republican Senate. We have a Republican supermajority, and we're not nullifying abortion. We're not breaking down the walls to adoption. We're not doing any of that. So don't kid yourself, folks. Don't kid yourself.
And I guess, Chuck, I guess before I bring it back to Jay and then bring some other callers in, we still have plenty of time to bring some things back around to other folks. And I want to okay, great. And so I've got some information here, someone brought up earlier, and this before we bring back to Jay, and then I have Polo Crew on the line that we'll be bringing in next after Jay's comments, is and just some statistics that I've got here. And of the deaths of those to be considered to the result of U.S. foreign policy between 1945 and 2003 range from 10,774,000 and seven down to 16,856,361. And also we have some statistics where every day 16,000 or approximately 5,840,000 per year children die from hunger-related causes. Of course, these figures, you know, very staggering and concerning. But if you compare these deaths caused by abortion, since being made legal in 1973, 42 million abortions have been performed in the United States. Worldwide, there has been approximately 46
Robert,
million.
It's more than that.
It's
somewhere between, you know, usually right now the figure you'll hear most is about 55 million, but it's certainly somewhere between 50 to 56 million abortions in the United States since 1973.
There's been 56 million 100 and some odd thousand abortions. And just to address the issue real quick, if somebody else wants to jump in, but I would love to address that issue of starving starving babies in other countries, of children that need to be adopted here in this country. Government is always the problem, as Ronald Reagan would say. And here's the thing. I care about babies in other countries, but it's not our job to make sure other countries are pro-life. It is our job. I mean, this is it's biblical to keep your own house before pointing out the log in your other in another's house, okay? It is our job here, ordained by Jesus Christ, our Savior, to make sure that abortion stops in our country. And that is what we need to do first. And that goes into other things, too. I mean, anything you want to talk about, we need to take care of our own house first here in America. That's one of the things I say when I'm trying to reach out to some of the homosexual community. I say, well, gay folks ain't having abortions. Maybe last year in North Carolina, we passed a defensive marriage amendment to the Constitution of our state. I am 100% in agreement with defensive marriage and a constitutional amendment for that for our state. But here's the thing. Where's our constitutional amendment against abortion? Why isn't that the first priority? And it does come down to politics, folks. It does come down to politics. And if you don't demand that these politicians eliminate abortion in your state and do every maneuver that they can to save these lives, what are they doing? They tell you they're pro-life. They go there. They represent you, and they vote on meaningless things that are pro-life. No, you get the damn job done. It's like you hire a contractor. I am a contractor. I go into people's houses. I rip apart their old crappy bathrooms with the chrome, with the brass fixtures.
But Chuck, real quick, Chuck. I do have other folks who want to come back in, so I want to, you know, be able to give equal time as best as I can to folks coming on the show. So I do want to bring it back to Jay and have him, because he's our guest tonight, special guest tonight. So I do want to bring Jay back into it for his comments. And then I did tell Polar Crew on the line, and I do see some other folks who like to chime in. I also want to bring it back to Valeria and to Kelly as well, because they've got some other, stories we want to bring in to the show. So I want to bring it back to you, Jay, and then I'm going to bring in Portland Crew, and I do want to let folks know that we do have about 30 minutes or so left of the live portion here on Bard's Logic, but of course we will be going into the extended version, which of course those who are on the line will remain on the show into the extended version. But those who have not called in, once the clock strikes midnight here in Eastern Time in about 39 minutes, then unfortunately those who have not called in will be cut off. So if you'd like to listen to the extended version live, call in at 347-945-7428. Again, it's 347-945-7428. And if you'd like to chime in, just push the 1 on your number dial to let me know. You come in, and I do see other folks you'd like to chime in as well, and I will be getting to you tonight, I promise. So that's why I want to go ahead and bring it back to Jay and then bring in Polar Crew in after those comments. Go ahead, Jay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chuck.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Chuck. There's a lot of passion there, and I agree with his passion. I probably wouldn't word some of the things he says the way he does, but I think there were some things there that we can comment on. First of all, there was the issue of talking about the constitutional nature of the ruling of it, because if you push back to slavery and you start talking what's going on in slavery, well, the 14th Amendment was supposed to be the antidote to slavery in the sense that it identified all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. At the end of the 14th Amendment, Section 1, the last little partial sentence there, the clause is, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. And what the Supreme Court did in Roe v. Wade was say that under the Constitution, the unborn human beings do not count as a person within the 14th Amendment. So they may be human life. Actually, Roe v. Wade and Justice Blackmun and his decision in both Roe and Doe, the companion decision that came out at the same time, sort of cowardly punts the whole question of whether or not they're human beings, saying we can't really determine it or that we're not able to determine it at this time, which isn't true. But he says that simply they cannot be persons under the law, and so they don't count. The state has no compelling interest to interfere there. And so constitutionally, it just says there may be such a thing as a human being. It enters into this discussion, this philosophical point into the law where it says there is such a thing as a human being that is not a person. And persons have rights and human beings do not have rights. And a sort of dualism that splits those two things up. It's a dualism that is never argued for under the law. They never give any justification for making that move or for why they can identify one group of human beings as human life, but non-personal human life that has no rights and for which we're allowed to do anything we want to it. But that is the big question that comes up again and again in the argument of the 14th Amendment as it comes into the abortion argument, is that we argue that all human beings are persons in the natural sense, and so they count as far as persons that cannot be deprived of life, liberty, property, or due process, and that they have equal protection of the laws. They might not have all of the rights of citizens that are what we call positive rights, rights that are given to them by the government. That would be like a right to drive your car, to have a driver's license, even the right to vote. Things like this that the government determines that an 18-year-old should be able to vote, a 16-year-old should be able to drive, a 21-year-old should be able to drink. These are places where the government is making law that has nothing to do with the nature of what we are as human beings. Those are called positive or legal rights that you have. But we're talking about our natural rights, rights that you have by virtue of what you are. When it talks about the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with inalienable rights, and among those rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They're endowed to them. They're natural to them. They can't be taken away. They're inalienable. You can't give them up even if you want to. You just have your right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness by virtue of what you are. And so when they say that under the Constitution they don't recognize unborn as persons, and we say that they are persons and argue for that, one thing I would want to caution Chuck against, though, is that legally, you know, let's go back to the turn of the going out of the 19th century into the 20th century, where abortion was illegal throughout the United States. Back then, even when it was illegal, we did not throw women into jail for getting abortions. There were several reasons for that. It was charged as a lesser charge than, like, a murder, and there are multiple reasons why this is done. One of them is that it's very difficult to prove that a woman, when she got an abortion, is what killed the child, because you have to have evidence that the child was alive prior to the abortion, that the act of abortion was what killed it, and that it was the act of the abortion that did it. Now, it's easier to prove that with born human beings in the case of murder in a trial than it is to prove that in a court of law. Another reason is that what they wanted was to destroy the network of doctors who were performing abortions, and so they needed the women's help in order to get to the doctors. And so oftentimes they're not going to prosecute the woman for murder and throw her into jail, because their goal was to destroy the network of doctors who were willing to do this. If they can take those away, then you effectively eliminate abortion, or to as much as you can eliminate abortion. Making it illegal doesn't eliminate it. What it does is it puts them in the class of things like rape and homicide and murder, things like that, that are restricted legally, where we have the government and the law informing the culture morally, and they're working to limit, as much as we're capable of limiting, all evil to that degree. And so it wasn't normal for women to be thrown in prison or in jail for abortion, even when it was illegal throughout the United States. What generally happened was that women were given the ability to fall into that same sort of prosecution level. Although women were jailed, it wasn't like they never were, but it was more to try to get to the abortionist. The idea that the coat hanger is representative of what life was like prior to 1973 and Roe v. Wade is just flat out false. Mary Calderon, and Scott talks about this in his book, The Case for Life, testifying before Congress and trying to get abortion made legal, was testifying that abortion was incredibly safe, that over 90% of the illegal abortions were performed by medical doctors and medical facilities, that 8% of those were self-induced abortions through some other means, and that 2% were the kind of back alley ones, and that it was the self-induced ones that were obviously wrong, but the deaths they lied about when they said there were 10,000. The deaths were much lower than that, sometimes somewhere between 60 to a couple hundred, depending on who you listen to or who you read. But she says, you know, Mary Calderon, the medical director for Planned Parenthood, is trying to argue at that case, while it's illegal, that it ought to be legal because it's incredibly safe. And it's this thing that's done by medical doctors, and it's not this back alley thing. The back alley thing was something that was driven to induce fear into people. And I will finally, on that last point, I will agree with him that political power is necessary, but we need to see where political power comes from. Political power comes from people, and a mass of people that agree with you. And in order to get that mass of people that you need to practice raw political power, you need to convince people that your position is right. And so we have to work to, at the same time as that we're working intelligently through the political system to limit and restrict abortion, we have to be working on a grassroots level to convince people that this is wrong, and to do so in an effective and impacting manner.
Well, what I would add to that would be that you're right. It does in a political manner to deal with things, as you do have to have a number of people to make that happen. The unfortunate thing is, as conservatives, we do not understand it as well as those have gone to the Lenin school of communism over in Russia, and been taught by communists like Obama and Patty Murray, who wrote the budget bill with Paul Ryan. Where we have the power is that the political process is very easy to figure out, and it does not take a majority. It takes a small, irate minority to be able to do these things. And I agree with you. Yes, I understand the history that doctors were doing these procedures. But what I would say is, we need to make it illegal. We need to put doctors in jail.
Certainly, Chuck. But I do have, I'm not trying to be rude to anybody, but I do need to have, I do have other folks, to bring in, and Kelly's got some other things he wants to add too. And I just want to make a correction here. When I said 42 million, that was a statistic that I had from actually 2009. And so
yeah,
if it's 56 now, we're talking about 14 million abortions just here in the United States just in the past 5 years. That's an increase of 14 million in 5 years. That's an incredibly sad stat. But I did here's
China.
How I'm going to do this now, ladies and gentlemen, is I am going to bring in Polar Crew in, and then I want to bring it back to you, Kelly. And I know you have something that you'd like to add. And then we'll continue on and get some other folks in here on the line. So thank you very much for holding for as long as you have, and for those who are still holding, I appreciate it. But we will bring it, many folks on, so we'll go with you, Polar Crew, and then we'll bring it back to you, Kelly, and then we've got some other folks to hear on the line who would like to chime in. So go ahead, Polar Crew. Thank you very much for calling in the show. How are you?
Doing well, Robert. Thanks for getting to my call. My name is Paul. Polar Crew is just my moniker. It's pissing off liberals and pissing off liberals and outing rhinos. Yeah, just so you know what it means, right?
Got it.
Some of my some of what I was going to touch on has already been expounded upon a little bit by some of the panel here. I would like to kind of hone in just a little bit on why we have such a difficulty in uniting some of the religious bases around right to life, and it gets down to where some of the different Christian religion, I don't want to call them sects because that kind of fits into almost a Muslim kind of think, but the different, the different Christian Lutheran, Baptist, certainly Catholicism, and even the Jewish faith. They all have a subtly different take on our right to life issue. The one that was the most surprising to me in reading up on this, and even listening to some debates between, church leaders, is the Jewish faith. And this was right from a rabbi that was a part of this, one of the discussions I was listening to. In the Jewish faith, their notion of a person is their sanctity of life really begins from a religious perspective at first breath, after birth, because that is their belief of when a soul is given to the child or the life that has just been born. So their view of sanctity of life is at first breath, because that is the point when the soul needs to begin to get nourished in the Jewish faith. So prior to first breath, in the womb, at first conception, and through the maturation ready for birth, certainly they have care deeply that the child be born healthy and that the child be given a chance at obtaining a soul. However, that's in stark contrast to, say, the Catholic faith of life begins, or the Christian child begins at conception. So there's a difference of opinion and a difference of religious practice, morals, values, et cetera, of where, of how bad abortion is. So, and then there's, and then some of the other faiths have a different, different, say, weight of value, or a different strength of values around at what point abortion is unconsiderable at all costs versus, you know, morally, you know, untasteful in others. So regardless of how I believe, how most of the folks on this call believe, which I am aligned with here, we need to realize what our social dilemma is here in getting getting things to how we would like to see them. So the grassroots area is really where we can, at least my opinion on this is, it's really the only place that we have to push the change forward. Because when this gets into the Senate, where this law, where such a law would need to come from, the House has the finances. Everybody should know the separation of powers is separation of powers, although old Bozo doesn't give a crap about them, and we can go on about that in some other session. The grassroots in the states need to push the states to where the social agenda, we want that social agenda to be. Now, if we try to do it from the top down, we're going to fail, and we will wind up with good conservatives losing races, because losing their you know, political races, because they're running in states where there's a independence, there's an independent demographic, as well as enough anti-government demographic that don't want government making laws like this. Whether we believe it should be there or not, we need to recognize that that's what's happening in the demographics, is they want less government, and this would be a controlling government saying you can't do something. So as we look at it from the top down, we will lose more races if this is a divisive issue for the candidates that we want in the House and Senate to correct this, the other things that the government should be looking at, our military, our financial, monetary systems, et cetera, right? So
what about a referendum? What about having a national referendum?
Well, national referendum would be
state, or even a state referendum.
That's where my head is right now, is that, you know, if it's getting the states together and having a state referendum, right, on this, right, I think that is entirely doable, because we can get enough states to recognize this and say, look, we 20 states are going to just throw out the Roe v. Wade thing and ignore it, and we're going to declare 10th Amendment that you didn't have the right to throw that at us anyway, so we're going to do what we want to do on this issue. Boom, we'll set the precedence, and other states, as they, you know, get their morality back, you might say, in a way, then they can come on board and join the referendum. But trying to do a top-down as where we put our energy, I think, is a failing proposition, because it's the other issues at the top of the government that we really need to focus on, how the candidates will correct those things. Runaway spending, too much law regulation. Get the hell out of our businesses so they can create jobs. We try to make our top-down government, the right to life, an issue for our top-down government, we're going to lose those candidates that we need to vote for the right things on our financial agenda and military agendas. Anyway, so that's what I wanted to kind of just bring into the conversation there, my thoughts on it. Thanks.
Well, I appreciate it, and we'll keep, of course, your mic open, and we're going to try to bring things around if we can with the other callers coming in. But before I bring in, we have another 386 here that we'll be bringing in shortly. But first, I want to bring the mic back to you, Kelly. So go ahead. You have the floor, and then we'll go with you, Kelly. Then we'll bring Jay back in as our guest tonight, and then we'll have a couple more mics here we can open up. Go ahead, Kelly.
Yeah, I wanted to, I'm not going to talk politics tonight for, well, I might later, but not now. You know, women, when they get pregnant, they are in a very difficult situation. It's extremely sensitive. And one of their challenges is, what am I going to do? How am I going to feed this baby? If I have this baby, oh my gosh, will everybody think about me? What about my parents? They're in a very distressed, shocked state. And one of the biggest questions is provision. Well, let's say I go ahead and have this baby. How am I going to provide for it? Well, that's where a story comes in about my son, James. So I was married coming up on 9 years, and we got pregnant. You know, it's a classic, marriage isn't doing good, so wife thinks, have another baby. That'll make things better. Well, my aunt, she goes, whatever you do, don't get pregnant. Don't have another baby, because our marriage was really struggling. Anyway, and I'm like, so we got pregnant. I mean, I guess I was a little bit freaked out because, oh, my gosh, I'm already on super adrenaline overdrive. How am I going to take care of this little family? I mean, you know, I love everybody and all, but it's just like where I live, Siskiyou County, we are so depressed, it's just stupid. Single moms abound. It's a lot of drugs, alcohol. It's unbelievable. So it's really tough, even though, you know, I'm an engineer. Yeah, I got clients here and there, but, you know, of course, clients can't pay. Why? Because they don't have money. All right, so anyway, so she, this is about provision. I'm gonna get there. So, you know, several months in, she files for divorce. I'm like, oh, my gosh, I created a son. How am I going to be a father to this child? I mean, my father died when I was 6, and I went through a lot of difficulties. I don't sleep around because I don't want to create a life I can't be a father to. Okay, so how am I going to be a father to this child? But you know what? This is where the good news is comes about the question of provision. I have seen God do amazing miracles. I wrote them down at 40. I stopped counting at 50. Okay, because why? Because I want to be in my son's life. And by the way, he's doing great. 97% of the standard reading exam. Everybody likes him. He's this awesome kid. Well, anyway, I mean, he's 8 years old now. It's been a very hard road for me. I mean, I could have said, okay, I'm just going to be a negligent dad. Like, you know, I think they're scum of the earth. They make a baby and they disappear, but that's another story. So, you know, I could have disappeared, make $150,000 a year somewhere else in a really good economy. But no, I'm here. You know, some of the miracles were like this, okay? My truck's about to die. I need a car. Oh, I found a car at a garage sale. $100. $100 for a car. Okay, only lasts a year, but, you know, that was one. I have seen miracle after miracle to help me to be here for my son. And so, you know, pregnant mothers might be thinking, well, how am I going to provide for this kid? Look, you have the God of creation looking out for you when you want to bring that life into the world and do your best and get with the community, get with the church, whatever it takes. God will do miracles. You know, I think it was John Mueller, and I'm trying to remember this great man of faith. He ran an orphanage in Europe. And the stories from his book, from his writings, I mean, orphanage, he had like 200 kids. You know, obviously they didn't want to have abortions, so they gave, you know, give it up to the orphanage. I mean, there's just like minimal paperwork. He had a few staff, and like these stories he kept writing about in his book and how somehow God kept providing over and over and over so he'd feed these kids. One of the stories was, you know, 7 o'clock at night, he's talking to his wife, and he's like, we don't have any food for the morning. We do not have any food. I don't know how we're going to feed kids breakfast. So he gets up early, you know, he's doing his devotions, whatever. All of a sudden, knock on the door. Old Uncle Baker says, hey, I got a whole bunch of bread. I got a wagon load of bread. You got hungry kids? I says, yeah. He kept these stories, and he did this for decades. He was running an orphanage. Why? Because the God of creation cares about children. He cares about the innocent. He cares about provision. I have seen these miracles in my life. I got to dig up these 40 miracles because, man, when I read them, I'm going to cry again. And that's, you know, with support, with, you know, crying out desperately to God, the provision will come so that a woman can carry her baby through to life.
Well, definitely, you know, as people pointed out a lot this evening,
you know, a lot, definitely a lot of passion out there, a lot of emotion out there as well. And so, Jay, I would like to bring you back into
Well, Robert, can I throw out another thought?
Go ahead. And then go ahead.
This is to the guys, okay? I mean, yeah, God bless you for fighting the fight. Maybe we'll get some legislation passed. But you know what? Have I not been an example of heart? This is what we need. It's heart. It's not our bodies carrying the baby. We don't know everything they go through. If we are more sensitive, if we are more understanding, supportive, I mean, arguments will not work when a woman's not thinking straight because she doesn't know what to do. It's heart. That's why some of the best people on this planet to attract a woman to keep her baby is another woman. We have to find ways to attract, even if we're guys, we have to find ways to attract a woman to make the right choice. And all these logical arguments, some will work, some won't. I mean, yeah, here's an argument, but how well does it work? Here's the argument. Sure, you have the right to choose. The creator of the universe.
Excuse me. Wait, I want to push back here for a second because I answered, I'm pretty sure it was after you talked earlier. I talked for about 2 or 3 minutes about how I worked for 3 years at a pregnancy resource center. I think that those people are heroes, that I support women and men who stand out at pregnancy clinics. I have said over and over again all night, and I talked specifically about examples supporting what you just said, that the idea that, but I, over and over again tonight, we have made it sound like it is one thing or the other. It is all of it. We need heart people out there fighting. We need pregnancy centers out there to providing and meeting those women where they need. We need people at the abortion clinics praying for those women and meeting them as they're walking in. We need people working in politics. We need people working at the grassroots level. We need people making arguments at the university level. It's got to be all of it. It's not either or. It's not one of us doing something and the rest of us are wrong. All of us are working towards the same goal. And so I appreciate everything you've said, and I support you, but it's not – we can't start casting this in the vision that there's only one way to do it, because we're attacking something that involves our entire culture, and we're trying to deal with it on the personal level, at the emotional level, at the political level, at the legal level, at the argumental and philosophical level. All of these things are just necessary. And so I don't want us to start to cast what everybody else is doing is not as important as what I'm doing, or that anybody tonight has said anything to the nature of that heart's not important. I've supported you.
I don't know if that was the intention. I don't know if that was Kelly's intention. I mean, I can't speak for Kelly, but and we'll give Kelly the opportunity to bring back on that. But go ahead, Jay, and then I just wanted to say that, and then we'll bring it back to you, Kelly.
I understand. He was. I just wanted to make sure that as we're not just Kelly, but everybody feels passionately about the way that they're approaching this, and they should. You know, you should be emotionally invested in this. But I think it's also important that we all remember we're all part of a bigger movement, and that bigger movement involves people doing things that just aren't what we do, that aren't our gifts, that aren't where we're doing it. But that doesn't mean that we aren't supportive of those areas and that we don't need to recognize the mutual importance of the whole field that we're working on. And kind of addressing, you know, Paul, you were saying that about top-down, and there's two things I wanted to address there. Number one, starting with the top-down thing, I don't think we chose for it to be a top-down thing. The other side chose it. And this is something that the other side has done quite effectively. And I think Chuck alluded to it a little without getting specifically into a lot of it. They were losing, on a popular level, arguments and fights that they knew they could never win. And so they went for the power of the full power of the government behind them, specifically the judicial branch.
They didn't come from the DOJ down on that. They came up from a local single grassroots movement around this, and they went up to the courts, and it took multi-years to do it. And that was a long, thought-out strategy on how they would go about achieving that. Now, they didn't get the ruling they want. They got something a little different, but that started at a local level with a strategy. They got a case, and they pushed it all the way through to the Supreme Court. Now, the left has accepted that and ran with it and codified it as freedom for women. Okay, and the right has been vilified by saying you as a demographic women, the right wants to take away your freedoms. So that's how this has come to be an albatross around the right's neck, is that we want to take away freedoms. So in order to change that, what we need to do is start that from a grassroots movement again. We can't do it top-down because the albatross is there. We can't fight that albatross off by changing the way that the Senate and the House work. Okay, so I'll get off of that for a minute now. Go ahead.
Well, if it were a full grassroots movement, it wasn't won by popular vote. It wasn't won by a bunch of people who were able to sway the population over to their side. What it was done was
a winning of court cases. There was no vote. There was no vote. There was no law crafted for this. Okay? It was a ruling
on
a case, which made a case law, and now they have a law on.
Hold on.
They have a ruling.
Hold on. Hold on, Paul. Is one of the things I have to enforce here, I have to do here, and it worked very well for us here on the show, is that in order for me to be able to keep the mics open as we do, I don't like people talking over other folks. Let's not do that. I'd appreciate it. And so let's keep it that way. And remember, we're all on the same team here. We all have the same goal. So go ahead, Jay, and then if you want to bring a little bit back, Paul, go ahead. But then I do want to bring it back to Kelly. And I do have someone else who would like to chime in. And also for those folks who are listening in, we do have about only 8 minutes of live time left, but we will have the extended version, which, of course, will not be able to be heard live unless you call into 347-945-7428. Again, it's area code 347-945-7428. But, of course, if you can't stay for the live version, the archive will be available for folks to share, and there's ways to do that. You can actually email it, download the audio, even can listen to it on your cell phone for later time or to share it to other people as well. So have people come in and listen to the show, and I appreciate everybody coming in both live on the calls, participating in chat, and listening from other areas. So if you'd like to call in and listen to the extended version or also chime in, do the call-in number, but you have to do it within the next 7 minutes in order to come in. So for all those who came and listened to the live show here of Bard's Logic tonight and our promotion of the Patriot Journalist Network Crusade to end abortion, and definitely check that out at www.patriotjournalist.com. And so we'll go ahead and we'll bring it back to you, Jay, and then if you want to have a few comment comments, Paul, that's fine, but then I want to bring it to you, Kelly, and then I do want to bring in 912 area code. You'll be coming up shortly. Go ahead, Jay.
Well, to finish up, what I was saying was that for example, Americans United for Life is an organization of people that I genuinely respect, and they're constantly working to challenge Roe v. Wade, which is a ruling by the Supreme Court that says that abortion is basically constitutionally off the shelf for the legislators around the country to deal with. They said this is decided as a constitutional issue, and all states are subject to the Constitution. And so organizations like Americans United for Life are working very hard to undermine the constitutional case made in Roe v. Wade, Doe versus Bolton, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the laws that dominate as far as how we're allowed to legislate on this in the country. Again, I want to get away from the idea this is an either-or thing. I agree with you on the importance of grassroots efforts. I just also agree that the efforts of Americans United for Life and what they're doing is important things. I just don't think that it has to be one or the other. And without getting dragged down, because I don't want this to become a purely political discussion either, but let me get back to something you said earlier, because I do think to categorize the breath of life as the Jewish view is a bit of an overstatement, because I wrote a PhD thesis by a guy by the name of Matthew Flanagan, a philosopher and theologian out of New Zealand, who I've met and spent time with when I was over in New Zealand, also some of the works of Ronald Sider and other people, who will point out that the pre-Christian Jewish church thought that abortion was wrong. And so, and believe that trying to take the life of the unborn was something that was not allowed under God's laws, especially stated within the Alexandrian Jewish community prior to Christ, which carried over into the Alexandrian Christian community. And so, I understand that that argument is made by a number of Jews today as far as a defense about abortion and the place of ensoulment. We obviously, when we're trying to convince people who are secular that this case is just, don't lean on discussions of ensoulment, but we talk about a value of human life. You mentioned the Catholic Church. I mean, most of the philosophers that I talk to and that I work with and that I quote are often Catholic philosophers. Obviously, there's a few Protestants in there as well, but a lot of Catholics when we talk about what we call the substance view of human life. But it is important, I think, to point out that in the Jewish tradition, it is not a unified front that the breath of life is this moment when life has value, because that doesn't explain why the pre-Christian church was against abortion and why abortion was something that they would see that the deliberate trying to kill of an unborn human life as something that was bad. And we have this directly stated in the writings of the Alexandrian Jews, then becoming the Alexandrian Christians. And also Ronald Sider has demonstrated that there's evidence of early church against, in his book about abortion killing and things of that nature, the evidence that he has there. And so you're right that that is an argument that is offered by a particular group of Jews, but it's not really the Jewish view. They're still, just like Christians are split on this, Jews are split on it. There's even very liberal Muslims that are somehow trying to justify this under Muslim law. So
here's the thing I would add real quick, if I could,
yeah,
just
yeah,
real
go
quick.
Ahead, Paul.
This is Chuck.
Hey, sorry about that. I guess I like to talk when my mute button's on, but for some reason nobody likes to listen.
Go ahead, Paul.
And then, yeah, I'll just very quickly. I think, as much as I really don't like to bring religion into a discussion about the right to life, my only point here is that we as a really a demographic here in a way, but we as Christian men and women, we on this phone agree where life begins and what we should be doing about getting abortion illegal. I that's where I am as well. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But getting there, getting our society there, requires us to recognize what the barriers are within not just our political landscape and how we pick our leaders locally and statewide and nationally, but also what the various religions, how they're split,
mm-hmm.
where they are struggling. Right. That's not to say that we need to go in and talk to those religions, but it's the art of war, right? If you don't know your enemy, you're not going to defeat them. Right? If you don't know how evil is proliferating, you're not going to defeat it. So that's where my energies are and my passion is understanding why we have such a terrific problem uniting good moral people around this cause. So I'll stop on that right there. That's all I had to contribute to that.
Go ahead, Jay, and then real quick, I know you got some comments, Chuck, but I did say I want to have Kelly come in and make some comments, and we do have someone who I did tell would be on the line. So here's how we're going to go, folks, and this is just some of the ways we have to coordinate it here where we have this many folks in line, which is fine. But here's how we're going to do it. We're going to go ahead and, Jay, make a few comments there, and then I am going to bring it to Kelly, and then we're going to bring in our next caller on the line, and then after that we will have Cindy come in because she's been wanting to chime in as well, and then we'll bring it back to you for your comments. Chuck, if you want to bring it back to a subject we were talking about a little bit. We do still have almost an hour worth of the show in the extended period, so we definitely have plenty of time to discuss this all-important and passionate topic. So we'll take the route that I pointed out and lead us. So go ahead, Jay, you started out.
Just you know, in response, I actually just agreed with what Paul said. I mean, the only thing I would say in addition to it was that in light of what he's saying, in agreement with what he's saying, that's why I think it's so important for us to be able to speak to the division of that there is not a unified Jewish view. So if somebody, in the event that I was standing and talking to a Jewish person, individual who identified themselves in that school of thought and made it idea that was particularly a Jewish view, I would be able to discuss with them that it wasn't universally a Jewish view and that there was a long Jewish tradition of seeing the unborn as something that had rights and value and that was the kind of thing that you ought not to kill and that to act against it or to work against it was considered a sin of God. So without having to make them believe that in some way they would have to violate some nature of their Jewish religion in order to agree with me, as opposed to just embracing that there was a group of Jews that actually agreed with that position and a long tradition of it stemming back to the pre-Christian Jewish tradition that was there before this. And that is their Jewishness should not be in the way of them joining our opinion on this, our view on this. Our view is right with good arguments and that there are good reasons to believe what we believe.
Okay, folks, we've got it back to you, Kelly.
Okay, well, as I mentioned on the show before, I come from a long line of Jewish hog farmers. the Jews were quite, what is natural? What is natural? It's not natural to take the coat hanger and kill a baby. It's just not natural. We aren't going to do that. But I got to go back to my previous point of men being more sensitive, and I think Jay is an excellent example. He understands these issues. He understands the multi-pronged, hey, you know, let's have a talk. Let's have a heart-to-heart talk, you know. And if I was going to use logic with a woman, you know, after you know, listening, I'd learn her situation. I'd empathize with her stress. I mean, I'm saying this stuff because, you know, I really blew it the first time I said, look, Susie, and I won't say her real name, but look, Susie, you know, I tell you what, $10,000 and I'll adopt your baby. That was so insensitive. So maybe even I'm saying this about myself and my blunder with the first time, even though it was a success, but she didn't abort, and I met Faith. But, you know, Jay, I think he's got it really figured out. And if we, as men, who want to solve problems, approach that, we're not going to win people over. But I think really gently conversing with, I'm going to go a little bit political in a bit, but in gently conversing with a woman in that situation, learning, listening, understanding, empathizing, and I think one of the logical arguments I would bring forth is, you know, hey, look, you know, you do have the right to choose. Okay? The God of creation wove freedom into every fiber of creation because love always offers a choice. The other fiber he wove into every fiber of creation, the other tenet he wove, every fiber, is you do not get to pick your consequences. And the consequences here, I mean, sure, you might solve a short-term problem, but there's so many women who have suffered terribly. And you know what? Let me give you some phone numbers of some ladies who have had an abortion, and you can understand the consequences that they're going to go through, that you're going to go through if you do this. Here are some ladies that chose to have the baby, and let's see what the blessings, you know, and you can learn from these two by the consequences that befall these, and you're no different. You will have these consequences. Because it's their tenets woven into every fiber of creation, and so you know I guess that's about the only logical argument I would gently bring up. But you know, in over time I'm going to some of the political aspects of this. But as long as we're separating the political from the personal, I think we'll have quite a bit of success.
One more
thought, if you will. And
go ahead.
You know, Roe versus Wade has been, oh my gosh, you know, dictating, legislating from the bench. We have this. Am I going political? All right. These are the circumstances that we're under because of Roe versus Wade. That's where we are. And the only thing we have, yes, to do political lobbying, but under our circumstance, we have to find ways to attract.
Mm-hmm. And at that, I do want to bring in our next caller. And so our next caller, 912, thank you very much for holding for all the time that you have. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Hey, thanks, guys. This is Gene with the People's America. And you guys really are not going to like what I got to say.
Well,
that's all right. We'll hang up on you.
Before you say it, Gene, that's fine. I mean, when the show first started out, we had a lot of debate here on the show, and as long as you know, even people who disagree are respectful to the audience and you know and to the guests and things of that nature, we don't mind having a little bit of debate here on the show. So, so go ahead. The People's
right.
America, is that who you're with?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think, first of all, the whole issue of abortion or non-abortion or pro-life is a religious value. And I think in today's society, that religion is losing ground every day. In my personal opinion, I'm with you guys. I don't think abortion is an option. However, as an American citizen and living in the 21st century, it has to remain an option. Because, first of all, sin is between you and God, and that depends on the God you're talking to. As you guys pointed out about the Jewish religion, and you know, a segment of it says life doesn't begin until first breath. You've got so many other fascists of religion out there. If the Christian religion today makes laws that determines how I have to live and I like it, that's great. But next week, next year, next election, another religious fascist takes over and makes laws that I don't like, then what? Our country was not founded on that. Our country was founded on what the people believe. We are supposed to be making the laws. And the religious values today have disintegrated. That's the first thing we need to address before we worry about addressing abortion is moral value. That's where we, the people, need to get off our butts and deal with it. Church population is dropping daily. Other religions are popping up daily. So with that being said, I could never support a political candidate that says they're going to dictate a political law based on a religious value. And that's where I think you guys will probably be upset, because I think the whole thing about Roe versus Wade, first of all, I don't think they determined when life was. I think that was the whole issue with Roe versus Wade, is when does life start? Is it at conception? Is it at first breath, first trimester, second trimester? And that's where the big loophole is, and nobody wants to touch it, not politically, because they know what it means to them. And with that being said, I'll let you guys, you know, respond or ask any questions. But that's why I'm totally opposed to, you know, mandating no abortion laws. Not only that, just about everybody on this call that I've heard before, and I've listened to your show several times, always mm-hmm. says, well, what about these food stamps? We need to cut this public assistance and the Medicaid and the Medicare. Well, you know what? Now you're saying let's bring these babies into the world. We'll throw them in an adoption center, or we'll throw them somewhere, or make these mothers have them, and then we're going to put them on food stamps and welfare. Well, so what do you want, really? I mean,
I would love to comment on this. This is Chuck.
Yeah, go ahead, Chuck. Actually, I'm going to bring the mic over to you, and then we'll bring it to Jay. Go ahead.
Yeah, I am not upset with, I can't remember our friend's name here, but
Gene,
and I am not upset with what Gene said at all. I totally understand why people have that point of view. I disagree, obviously, and that is why that it is our job to go through politics to change things to be the way that we want them. If you know, there's all kinds of new sexual preferences, they're saying. Pedophilia is a sexual preference, so maybe we shouldn't imprison folks for that and other things. We have to make a stand at some point, and I think that it's a very easy decision for most of us to make the stand that we will force doctors to stop performing abortions, and that is what I want to use the government for. I don't want to use the government to force anybody to stop smoking pot or doing any of the gay homosexuality. I don't want to use the government to force anybody in that. It's a human life. And if you're an atheist, and you just say it's an animal life. It has its own unique DNA. You do not have the right to kill it. There are laws against murder. Now, we can debate that, and we can change laws to where you're allowed to murder some people. We have the death penalty. You can be convicted of a crime, and in some states, you can be charged and executed with the death penalty. Well, that issue is left up to the states. Now, the big argument is the Supreme Court has decided they don't know when life begins. Well, guess what? It's not their decision to make. And until we realize that it is, I'm with you. I feel the emotion. I love the compassion stories. The compassion stories do work. I'm not saying they don't. What I am saying is if you want to completely stop abortions or limit them to the least amount possible, you can't make it to where the Republican nominee is saying, I know I'm being repetitive, the Republican nominee is saying, go get a letter from a judge or a teacher and you can go to a clinic down the street and get you that life cut out of you. If we elect people that believe that type of crap, then we're going to lose. And I have all the sympathy in the world for the opinions of those, like our friend Gene here. But I have that sympathy, and I'm willing to listen to it. I'm not willing to sit on the sidelines politically and not go and crush everybody that thinks like Gene politically and put people in positions of power to overcome that mindset. We have to be willing to stand up for life to the point where, yes, I do want to control that woman. I do want to control her from stopping having a baby. Yes, I am a man, and yes, I don't care because there's tons of women who back up everything that I'm saying right here. They cheer me on when I do it. They beg for more men to get involved and to stand up and to say what I'm saying. You can call, I'm mean, I'm this, I'm that. You can say whatever I am. One thing you can't say is that I'm not pro-life because I am, and I am willing to use the force of government to enact that.
And before I bring it over to you, Jay, there's just some comments I want to bring about, you know, about the people accepting the food stamps and things of that nature. Because I know that's, you know, definitely an argument. You know, some suggest if one is opposed to abortion, they ought to be open to accepting unwanted children. But a question I'll ask, and you know, is, well, should we also apply that logic to those who were killed in hunger and wars? And what I mean by that is, over time, could we imagine what, you know, because people talk about world population and hunger and things of that nature, feeding people, but can you imagine if all the people who died in wars across the world didn't die because of that? Now, are we saying that, well, war is good because it keeps people from starving to death? Because if there wasn't war, there'd be so much more so much more people alive in populations that would need to eat. So we should promote and allow, you know, and try to have wars every, you know, where we can. Because if not, well, then we'll have so many more people that would be hungry. I just don't see where that logic would apply, especially in the light of, you know, putting it in a war analogy. Jay, if you'd like to make any comments on any of those, go ahead.
Can I respond to that?
Well, first I'm going to bring Jay in, and then go ahead, Paul, and then we'll and then I want to bring James back in. We haven't heard from James for a while, so Jay, and then we'll bring it to you, Paul, and then James. Go ahead, Jay.
I just want to ask you a couple of questions, Gene, and for the purposes of everybody else getting a chance to talk, I just want to keep this dialogue as brief as possible, but I want to understand your view a little better, okay?
Okay.
Do you think it requires a religious argument to say that it is wrong to kill another human being without justification?
I think that, yes, it's a religious argument.
So you think that just all murder laws, and generally all murder laws in the United States are religious laws?
Yes.
Okay. So you don't think that there's a philosophical way to know, or you don't think there's a way to know that something is wrong without it being rooted in a religious position? So laws against rape are wrong because they're religious, but all those laws are religious laws. If we say rape is wrong, it's a religious position.
Look at the Muslims.
Well, I'm asking you, do you think that the term rape is wrong is an inherently religious position to say that it is wrong to rape?
Yes.
Okay. So if you're saying then you said that abortion has to remain an option because the question of the nature of the unborn is a religious question, but you just also said that all moral laws are religious questions. So why?
That's right. That hence the word moral. We get our morals.
Wait, Gene.
Okay.
I sort of ask short questions here. Okay. Because now I want to. So do you think that murder then has to remain an option, just in general, and should not be illegal because it's a religious question, it's a religious issue, or that rape has to remain an option because it's a religious law and it's a religious statement to say that rape is wrong or that murder is wrong? Would you say that those two things have the same commitment to it has to be an option?
I'm saying yes, because depending on where you're standing in the world, rape is not rape.
I define rape as the forced physical sexual act on a woman without her consent. And so I believe that there's such a thing as objective moral values. Now, there are atheists out there, by the way, completely non-religious atheists, who believe in objective moral values. Michael Martin, Sam Harris, people that I talk to every day that are atheists and pro-lifers. That these people don't believe that all values are subjective. They think that there's such a thing as objective moral values. They think that when we say rape is wrong, that we're saying something meaningful. Sam Harris, like I said, one of the most famous atheists in the world, fights for the idea of female genital mutilation within Muslim populations should be outlawed because it's objectively wrong, whether that community thinks it's okay or not. But I think what I'm hearing that you're offering us is a relativistic position, that in some places, if that culture says that it's okay, then it is just simply okay by virtue of the agreement of that culture. Is that right? Am I correct?
That's correct. That's correct, because your values are at one level, and once again, I want to clarify this. I'm a Christian. I believe 100% in the Lord Jesus Christ and the Holy Bible. However, what I'm saying is that for the laws of abortion to be enforced on people, this society in the United States of America, that we have to ignore every other religious value out there. We have to ignore the fact that it's the people's choice. That's what this country's founded on. The decision to have an abortion or not to have one is between the woman, the God of her choice, and her doctor. It's not for me to decide or you to decide.
Well, real quick, I don't do this a lot, but I will at this point, is that, okay, so wait a minute. So we mentioned earlier the possibilities of making abortion illegal in this country. One of the things that we suggested, and I don't know if you were on the, if you're listening into the show or not at that point, Gene, but we talked about a statewide, or even a federal-wide, but we'll speak to the statewide. What if there's a statewide referendum, okay, and, you know, the state said, hey, look, they did a state referendum, and it was deemed that abortion would be made illegal because that's what the people voted. And let's take it to the next step. However unlikely,
but just for the argument's sake, okay, let's just say that all 50 states individually through state referendums said, hey, abortion's illegal. Should it still, would that be enough for you to say, yeah, you know, in this country, abortion should be illegal? Because the people voted for it. It was a referendum. I mean, it comes from the, you know, we the people. So would that stand as abortion be illegal then?
The state of Mississippi almost did that. They were like less than 1% away to doing that. I think it was in 2009 or 2010. I'm sorry, 2010 or 2008, if I remember the years correctly. I agree with you. If the state says let's do it, and there's enough people in the state that says let's do it, if you don't like it, move your ass somewhere else. I'm cool with that. I just don't think our federal government needs to mandate that. The people need to mandate that. I just don't see any state being able to do that. Again, Mississippi almost succeeded at it. Now, I was very proud of Mississippi for trying it. But I just don't see that happening today because of the mixed culture that we have. And, one, I think that the federal government's got a lot more fish to fry rather than abortion. I think the federal government just needs to stay the hell out of it. I mean, on this very show, we've talked about many times how the federal government needs to stay out of our businesses and let our businesses grow and create jobs, but now we want them into our living room and into our bedroom. At the same argument on this very show, you've had about the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, how they're forcing businesses to buy contraceptives in their health insurance. So I think politically, it's not going to happen. That it's a waste of time. I think religiously and personally, I think that you need to concentrate on getting people into the churches and building that moral value rather than arguing the fact about an abortion. You need to save that mother's soul first and have her believe in God. Then you won't have to have this conversation.
Hey, Kelly here.
Real quick, Kelly, I did want to bring. I apologize, but I do want to bring James in. We haven't heard from James for a while, and so I do want to bring it back, James. If you'd like to chime in on anything you've heard here, and then we'll bring it over to you, Kelly. Then we'll bring it over to our guest Jay, and then I do want to bring Cindy back into the conversation as well. So we did say we're going to bring her back, and so let's take it from there. So, James, go ahead, and then Kelly, if you may just be brief so we can get the other people in who we haven't heard from for a bit, such as I had a brain freeze there, Cindy. go ahead, James.
Well, while everybody was talking, I was listening, and I was looking up some statistics. I love statistics and whatnot like that. And a few things that I think needs to be taken into consideration is that the pro-choice lobbyists try to make it sound as if the vast majority of Americans support abortion, when in fact 65% of Americans disagree at the least with abortion after the first trimester. Now, of course, we're talking about abortion, you know, in its entirety, you know, not being legal. But if 65% of Americans support that it should not be legal after the first trimester, then it's not a very far leap to take it to at all. It really isn't. If 65% of Americans, and let's face it, most people in America strive to be tolerant and strive to be agreeable. That's one of the things about the melting pot. It's both a curse and a blessing. If 65% of the people agree with that, then if shown the actual medical facts behind it, if they were educated in it instead of being inundated with a one-sided argument, I believe that 65% after the first trimester would probably increase, would become 65% at all. That it shouldn't happen at all. Again, it boils down to a matter of education. Now, this isn't even throwing in the religious dynamic into the argument. And then there's another one, and I'm sure everybody here enjoys being an American. I know I do. Currently, in the United States among American natural-born Americans, the fertility rate in the United States is only 1.6 out of every two people. That is an unsustainable rate for the American culture. There are fewer people being born than you have to have
the replacement rate.
Right, our replacement rate is not occurring. We are not matching one for one for every person, or two for two, since it takes two to tango.
And I would say that that's part and parcel why our federal government is so lax on having illegal immigrants coming in as a staple in our population. But go ahead.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because with legal Latino immigration, our fertility rates with legal Latino immigration currently stands at the bare minimum to maintain the nation of the United States of America at 2.11. Now, this is a known demographic fact. If you were to throw in, let me pull up my calculator here. I even went and did a little math, and that's like my least favorite subject, but I understand how to figure out percentages. What the 1.6 fertility rate among Americans, if you were to have canceled out the 55 million abortions that have occurred since 1970 legally, would increase to 1.872, which is still, just among natural-born Americans, still not a sustainable rate. However, if you were to throw that in with a legal Latino immigration, combined with those born in the United States, we would have a growing population. Now, back to what you said, Robert, with the why they're so lax on the illegal immigrants, I would say you're more than likely right, because without increased immigration or increased birth rates in the United States cannot sustain itself, simply cannot. It's not a matter of we wish it would. At the current rate that we are going, the United States cannot sustain itself. So you could throw all religious aspects of it completely out. You could throw them completely out and base it completely on survival of the culture, the American culture, the American society, the American nation. If we want this nation to survive, we quite simply have got to have more children. Well, the easiest way to do that, and it is, again, throwing all morals out and religious aspects of it out, would be to outlaw abortion so there are more children being born, whether or not people want them or not. And if we want this nation to continue, we're going to have to make a tough choice like that. Yeah, do we simply open up the borders and allow anybody in, or do we take actions that would bring about the birth of more Americans? And obviously, even with the legal Latino immigration, we're still sitting at the precipice. And I would have to say that just from a civilization standpoint, if we want the American civilization to continue, it should be made illegal. There should be strict punishments meted out for it. And that's just simply because, let's face it, look at the rest of the world and look at the United States. And as bad as things are here now, it's still better than anywhere else in the world. And, which is sad considering the state of affairs that we're in. But there need to be not only encouragement to not have children, or the discouragement to have children rather needs to be removed, but there needs to be encouragement to have children. That encouragement would be, I don't know. Obviously we don't want another great big government program or dumping tax dollars into things. But there needs to be encouragement for people to have children, because if the American nation, if our culture is to continue, we quite simply must have more children. And you can completely throw any religious argument in that out. And the government, I mean, like you said, Robert, I believe the government understands, well, they understand, if anybody understands demographics, it's a politician. And because, I mean, that's their bread and butter to getting reelected, is demographics, demographics, demographics. And, I personally love America. And if we had to relax our immigration laws and speed it up in an electronic fashion so we could get more people in the United States to sustain our nation, I would be all for that. But we should also, as Americans, do everything we can to sustain us, to sustain our nation. And the easiest way to do that is to increase birth rates, and the easiest way to increase birth rates is to stop children from being killed before they're ever born.
And Jay would like to make comment on that, and then we'll go to you, Kelly, for some brief comments, and I do want to bring it to Cindy. Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, I've got a quick comment if I can, Robert. The bringing it back, and I hate to keep coming back to religion on it, but I will anyway. As we know, the Jews did not wander in the desert 40 years. They survived in the desert for 40 years as they rebuilt their army before they headed to Jericho. So there's the notion of the ancient times in older times or just recent times, the notion of not killing one's unborns got to more of the population in many cases than it did of virtuous values. So I'll stop at that.
Okay, Kelly?
Well, who was that, by the way, that just spoke? I'm sorry.
That was Jay?
That was Paul.
Not Jay. That was Paul? Okay, all right.
That was Paul.
That's okay.
I'm getting all these voices mixed up. I've been going since 8:30 this morning. So it's been kind of a long day. It's kind of, things are starting to get mixed. Or should I say 8:30 yesterday morning? Go ahead, guys.
I would just, very quickly, going back to, this is Jay, but I want to go back to really quickly what Gene said, and then I'll drop it and move on. What Gene expresses is an entirely different worldview in the sense of that if you absolutely believe that there's no such thing as objective moral values or moral facts that we can know. When I argue abortion on university campuses, when I go to schools, when I equip people to have this conversation, we don't discuss religion at all. I discuss the science of embryology to identify the unborn as human beings and the philosophical position of how we determine whether or not human beings have value. Obviously, I take the position that all human beings have value by virtue of what they are. But I don't bring religion into it. It never touches it. But this argument is based solely on two principles. One, that I can identify a human organism. And two, that there are real and knowable moral facts that we can apprehend as human beings. And so when I say abortion is wrong, I'm not making a religious statement. I'm making a moral statement, a statement that I believe corresponds to reality, that it is wrong to kill an innocent human being in the same way that it is wrong to murder a human being, in the same way that it is wrong to rape a human being, the same as wrong to torture a toddler for fun. All of these are moral facts that are true and knowable and that correspond to a real state of affairs. And this isn't a religious argument. This is a philosophical argument. And you can deny that we can know moral facts, but at that point, then, if you embrace the kind of moral relativism that we were discussing earlier, what happens is you create a world that doesn't make sense of our intuitions about the world that we live in. For example, if a culture can decide what is right and wrong, and it's right or wrong by virtue of the majority of people in the culture saying it, then people like Gandhi, far from being morally laudable, were actual moral reprobates because they were wrong. The whole culture said one thing was the way it ought to have been. If somebody stands up and says that is wrong and works for moral change, moral reform, the moral reformer himself is wrong by virtue of going against what the laws are. William Wilberforce, when he began his anti-slavery, his abolitionist movements in England, by the definition of moral relativism, where a culture decides what is right and wrong, you put William Wilberforce into the role of bad guy because he is, by definition, wrong for going against what the majority of the people in the culture think. But we see him as a moral hero for standing up for the rights and principles and the true moral laws that govern us, and that those laws are being violated. In the same way that we see people like Frederick Douglass or any of the abolitionists that were fighting in the United States and doing something good even when the majority of people weren't on their side. So cultural relativism doesn't make any sense of the way that we understand the world around us. And I don't think that we have to rely on a religious position to be able to say that certain moral facts are true and knowable, because I know a lot of non-religious people that, you know, we may disagree on how we ultimately ground those facts, but we don't have to appeal to a religion to say that it is wrong to murder a child. We simply do not have to. We can know that without being religious by nature. Now, ultimately, as a Christian, I will explain that state of affairs. But the real is an objective, knowable fact that says that it is wrong to kill children. I will explain it in a Christian worldview, which, by the way, I believe is objectively true and is a fact that corresponds to the way things are, which is why I evangelize and try to convince people the truth of Christianity. If these facts can't be known and are not objective and true, regardless of who agrees with them, then there's no reason to try to convince anybody of them, any of them. You know, abortion just becomes something else in a whole line of things that we couldn't possibly legislate because we don't have agreement on it. And Hadley Arkus said, in addition to the idea, if you argue that we can't make it illegal because so many people disagree about it, an absence of consent is not an absence of truth. Just because everybody doesn't agree doesn't mean there isn't a true position. And we have to argue to that position. And then once we apprehend that truth, educate others so that they can get on the right side of things. Not just wait for everybody to agree.
No, I agree with that. I mean, you know, I myself, when I argue the abortion topic, I refrain from using, well, for one, you know, the people who listen to the show regularly, you know, that, you know, I'm not really of a religious sort. You know, I'm not Christian, but I do, I'm against abortion, but I never use, you know, religious arguments. Because not everyone's religious, and I think that a lot of the arguments fall on deaf ears when you try to, you know, use it as such. But I do want to bring it along with you, Kelly, because we do only, unfortunately, have about 20 minutes of live time or an extended period of time before I have to shut down the show. So a couple brief comments, I know, with you, Kelly, and then I want to bring it back to you, Cindy. So, Kelly, go ahead.
Okay. Jay had some really good points. I want to talk about William Wilberforce. He is one of my heroes. If you ever watch the movie Amazing Grace, you will be stunned, inspired. He was fighting an absolute uphill battle. He was trying to end the slave trade. He did it. He tried to end slavery, period. He saw it in his life, and then he died 3 days later. He had a huge, huge tactical advantage. What he did, see, the MPs were ruled by, and I'm going to get to a tactical advantage with pro-life here in a minute. Okay. Wilberforce was facing an MP that was run by whom? Other MPs that were elected by Howe? The slave trading corporations kept putting their people into parliament. Well, he figured out a way to beat the system tactical, which was this. The British government no longer protect British trade ships that flew the American flag. Pirateers took down the ships. The slave trade went under. The MPs couldn't get their people in, and pretty soon he ended the slave trade through legislation. And the most important feature of the whole story of Wilberforce was that he was buried at Westminster Abbey. If you're from Great Britain, you understand that is that is the highest honor the British has. So he did awesome things, but it was tactical advantage. Here's one, and I got a second tactical advantage if we have time. As an incredible tactical advantage, if a state stands up, we had a previous talker discussing nullification of the states, would just stand up with federal government and outlaw abortion. Well, that's one tactical advantage, but we need to go into that deeper. But instead of outlawing abortion, period, make it a crime for anybody to perform an abortion. That takes the wind out of the sails of, well, it's a woman's right to choose. Yeah, she can still choose to have an abortion. It's just that someone else can't do it for her. It takes the wind out of their sail. That's a tactical advantage, like William Wilberforce had. So if you make it illegal for someone, anybody, period,
be it a doctor, a nurse, nurse practitioner, or a plumber, if they can't do abortions because it's a state law crime, then you take away the, well, what's the woman has the right to choose? Yeah, she still can. Go into the kitchen and do her deed. But nobody can help her because it's a crime. You see what I'm saying? That it's a slight little twist, but it ends so much of the, well, a woman has the right to choose. Yeah, so what? Go do her own abortion. Okay, so that's a huge tactical advantage. Now, the other thing with state nullification, it's going to take more time because I need to ask some people some questions. Like one question, I mean, this is political, but the question is, let's suppose that the federal government took their hands off of it and let the states decide and say, let's see, 37 states. Why do we pick 37? Because that's how many states approve of the sanctity of marriage, which is a man or a woman, and basically have outlawed gay marriage. So let's suppose that the states had the issue in their hands, no longer federal issue. How many lives would be saved if, say, even just 25 states made it illegal for someone to perform an abortion? How much more progress would that be?
Was that an open-ended? Was that open-ended, or do you want some folks to?
I seriously want people to answer that question because you know, Roe versus Wade is law of the land. If the Fed said, "All right, we're done with abortion. Let the states decide." Now, let's say half the states approve, the other half make it illegal for anybody to perform an abortion. How many lives annually would be saved?
Well,
depends on the state. Go ahead.
You brought it. If I could just interject real quick, and I'll keep it short because I know we're running out of time. I was just recently at a 10th Amendment Center conference with the up in Topeka, Kansas, and they had the Secretary of State for Kansas there, along with 24 other Kansas state legislators. It was a very, very interesting conference. One thing that they're doing right now, and I would think it would apply to anything, because they're basing it on the 10th Amendment and the sovereignty of the states, because the creation, which the federal government is never supposed to be more powerful than the creator. The states, the creator of the federal government.
Correct.
What they are doing is they have already got 11 states signed on to an interstate compact, and what this interstate compact will do is basically outlaw the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare. If 34 states sign this interstate compact, it goes before the House, which, as we all know, has passed many bills getting rid of Obamacare completely. This never goes to the Senate, and it never goes to the President. It's basically like a constitutional convention light. They just don't tamper with the Constitution. If 34 of the 50 states agree that something should be legal, illegal, or legal, and it goes before the House and the House passes it, it's therefore legal throughout the legal or illegal, depending on the compact, throughout the United States. Now, if 34 states were to get together and do the same thing with abortion, for whatever degree. It would not go before the Senate, and it would not go before the President. It would just simply be what the House voted on. Now, since they can do that with Obamacare, one would think that they could do it with abortion. And I'll pass the mic.
Well, no, this is huge. You're talking about an Article 5 convention, which is amendment process.
No,
34 states...
It's an interstate compact. That's not an Article 5 convention. I was saying it's like an Article 5 convention light. They don't touch the Constitution. They're simply passing a law that will be universally recognized across the United States.
Well, the problem is states are not allowed to have treaties with other states. That's in the Constitution. So it's kind of interesting. But if I go on the model, okay, I'm just thinking ethereal a little bit here. If we have 34 states say, look, Congress, let us decide. We want pro-life. We are the creators, the framers of the Constitution as states, and therefore, hands off, let us decide. We're going to have a pro-life state. We're going to outlaw anybody doing abortions. And pretty much the feds are going to be in the position of, I guess we can't shove abortion down their throats. That's huge. and that's state nullification. That's Tenth Amendment.
Well, that's exactly right.
We'll definitely have to, have another show on this issue because there's just so much information and topics we can cover and solutions that we can discuss. But unfortunately, we only have less than 15 minutes left of discussion time before I have to shut things down. So what I want to do is I want to bring this to Cindy. And Cindy, give you some time to chime in about pretty much everything that you heard tonight. And then we still have, good six folks on the line, so we won't even have time to give everybody a full minute to, say any some last parting words. So what we'll do here is I want to thank everybody for coming in tonight. I want to thank the panelists. I want to thank James and James and Cindy and Kelly for coming in and to the shows. You guys do almost every show to be the panelists on the show. And also, of course, our guest here tonight, Jay. And then, of course, for all the other callers who called in tonight and there's still on, such as yourself, Gene, thank you very much for calling in. So what I'd like to do is bring the mic over to you, Cindy, because we haven't heard from him for a bit. And then I'd like to get some parting words from our guest, since he is our guest tonight. And then I'd also, I'll have to think down from there, unfortunately. And we'll definitely love to have everyone else here who's called in tonight back on the show for this topic and, of course, others. And we'd definitely like to have yourself on again, Jay. And if you get the opportunity to talk to Mr. Klusendorf, to have him come in and talk about his book and more about your organization, Life Training Institute, we'd love to have him on, and we really enjoy having Mr. Klusendorf on. And then, thrilled to me as well, since I bought his book some years ago, and read it and really enjoyed it. And it'd be just a thrill for me to actually be able to speak with him. So, if that's something you could talk with him about coming on, we'd really appreciate it. But go ahead, Cindy, and then we'll leave the last comments in to Jay, and then I'll close up the show. Go ahead, Cindy. We've got about 4 minutes before I have to go ahead and bring it back to Jay and close things out. So go ahead, Cindy.
Well, first of all, gentlemen, thank you so much for being here and talking about this issue. Thank you for being present at this issue. Women, I'm a woman, of course, and I'm telling you, I recognize that when I had children inside of me, they weren't me. They were somebody else. I wasn't the one kicking the inside of my stomach. They have a heartbeat of their own. They had a nervous system of their own. They even have feelings and insecurities, we have found out through ultrasound. When Roe v. Wade was decided, there were a lot of things about babies that we didn't know. But we know better now.
Mm-hmm.
So what Gene was saying, if it's a religious issue for murder, I can't speak to that. I think that he's sort of right because just as our founder said that the Creator gave us certain unalienable rights, and among those were life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. When you talk about the life that the Creator gave us, we know from scriptures that he recognizes that the person inside of a woman is a person. He knit them in the womb, and the baby leapt within her because of the Holy Spirit. I mean, those things we as Christians know from reading the scriptures. But now, to secure those rights is another thing. And that's what our Constitution is for. However, the only place we have in the Constitution that we can speak to is where it says that our Constitution was written in order to establish justice and to promote the general welfare and to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Now, there is no liberty when a person can be murdered for any reason whatsoever. There is no justice when a person can be murdered for any reason. We have to be a country of laws that protect the innocent, and whether that's a religious, a moral thing or not, I don't really care. What it means is that if we want to live as civilized human beings, we're going to have to do something to stave off evil people that want to do harm. And one of the things that we need to do is to save the babies inside the womb. And the thing is, though, we need to change hearts and minds. If we want some kind of legislation to be done, we can make it easier on our legislators by making it so prevailingly the idea of Americans to get rid of abortion that they don't really have a choice but to give us laws against abortion. Right now we're somewhere at about 50%. That ought to make them sit up and take notice. I don't think it's really doing that yet. So our job is to make it more than 50%. We've got to get 75% of our nation understanding what abortion is and that it is taking a human life. How can we do that? Well, I think that one of the best things you can do is to hook up with your local pro-life group, because they can get you materials, pamphlets, videos, whatever you need to spread the word around. There's so many creative ways to spread pamphlets around. I tape them to the inside stalls in girls' restrooms. The lady that was on earlier today and told the story about the doctor that she met, she disguises herself in different wigs and different clothing and different disguises. She goes into the abortion clinics on a regular basis and goes into the bathroom and puts things in there. Those are things that we can do that will, and these pamphlets can inform people that that baby has a heartbeat, that has a nervous system, and they can, pictures of the baby, what it looks like. It's not a gray blob. It is a human form. And they go on walks. They have sign waiting. They work at women's clinics where women can get help that become pregnant and they don't want to be pregnant. there's a ton of different things you can plug into by getting hooked up with your local pro-life group. And we have to maintain a presence. If people don't see us, if they don't see the issue out there and be forced to deal with it in their heads and in their hearts, then they will forget it. Because let's face it, an issue like this that is very passionate, as we have been tonight, an issue like this that is very controversial, people don't want to deal with it. They can't stand controversy. They can't stand too much passion about stuff like this. So we need to get in their vision, because they're trying to get out of our vision. And so we've got to find ways, and we have to save babies. That's all there is to it. I think Robert believes there's a God, but he does not understand he doesn't believe the complete hands-on that God has. And that's one thing I wish I could get through to you, Robert, is that when God sees what we're doing here and he doesn't put hands on, I would be afraid of that, because I would say he is seething with anger, and that at one point, as patient as he is with us, he will eventually let loose his wrath. I think this is the very issue that could happen. I hate to cut you short,
and I definitely would, you know me, I would definitely enjoy having a theological discussion with you, philosophical discussion with you.
I know I will, and I'm sure I will.
But unfortunately, and maybe we'll do that actually on a show at some point. That might be interesting to some of the audience. But if not, that's fine too. We can just do it, off the air. But I do want to bring it over to you, Jay, and want to thank you very much for coming on. It was great to have someone from the Life Training Institute such as yourself onto the show. And unfortunately, I only got about a couple minutes for you to make some party comments before I have to shut things down. So go ahead.
I appreciate the opportunity to be on with you guys. I have enjoyed this conversation. I've enjoyed all the places of agreement, and I've enjoyed the places of disagreement, and have the opportunity to exchange ideas and have everybody sort of push around where we're coming from on this. I would just say to close off, what we do at LTI is that we go out and our goal is to equip people to have a conversation in this culture where we frame the pro-life position in a way that can compete in the marketplace of ideas using science and philosophy, and by focusing people on the central question is, what are the unborn? This is not just us doing it. We train people to do it, and I train people in churches. I train people at universities. I give lectures at universities. Just last year, in the last couple of years, I've lectured at Harvard, Auckland University, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And one of the things that you see is that people come up to me from all different walks of life and say, after that presentation, I was pro-choice, and now I really have to rethink my position because I never thought of it that way. Or they will come in and say, I was on the fence, and I now consider myself pro-life, because the argument itself is obviously, in the position that we hold, true. It appeals to the facts of how they understand the world around them, their intuitions, and how they grasp the world. And this isn't just on an intellectual level. I mean, I train crisis pregnancy centers. They don't reach out, and I appreciate so much what Kelly was saying. We understand we're appealing to a whole human being, and there's an emotional and a spiritual person that we have to appeal to. But there's also a logical person, a rational person in there, and all those elements have got to be appealed to. And I know from talking to pregnancy center counselors, and I know from talking to people who counsel on the street, who talk to these people, that the whole arsenal that they bring, the whole quiver of arrows, their spiritual commitment, their emotional connection, and their rational dialogue with these people, tactically handling these conversations, makes a difference. I hear testimony after testimony after testimony of people all over the world who say that because I felt equipped to have this conversation, it went well. And the person walked away, and I always tell people, this is how victory should look to you. Very rarely in a personal conversation, except for obviously under the pressure of a woman who is on the verge of getting an abortion. When you're talking to someone and trying to change their minds, try to frame the argument, what we want them to hear is what we say, our argument, and walk away from it saying, I never thought about it that way. I'm going to have to think about this some more. And that's a victory for us because overwhelmingly people aren't grasping this concept of objective moral values, real rights, real wrongs, and that when we say that abortion is wrong, what we mean is not that I don't like it, but what I mean is that it's wrong for all people at all times to unjustly take the life of an innocent human being, even one at the earliest form of its development, the earliest stages of its development. And so it's a pleasure for us to do what we do, and it's a pleasure to be able to engage people who are doing other aspects within the pro-life community and to hear what's going on and the different plans and the different ways that they're approaching it. And especially a pleasure to hear the stories of the personal interactions and people's lives being saved. And I thank you all, everybody that I've gotten to talk to tonight, for the passion that you bring to this movement, for the passion that you brought to this discussion.
Well, thank you very much, Jay. And I'll have to end it at that before the show just shuts us off. So I want to thanks again, everyone. And I definitely will want to ask again if you can ever talk with Scott Klusendorf, and I'd really like to have him on the show. I think it'd be a personal pleasure to me to actually have him on the show and have a discussion with us, a conversation, especially, as I said, with reading and having his book. It'd be a pleasure. But I will end tonight, folks, as I do every night, and that is with the song by Aubrey Ashburn. And you can hear more of her music by going to www.aubreycareeveryone.com. Have a good night, and we will see you next Wednesday.